Call a meeting to order. Representative Eastland, would you like care to move the minutes from the March 8th meeting? I'm sure you've looked over
that. I'll move them right out of my...
Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Not all of the papers signified by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposing, same motion prevails. Representative Moe, House File 231.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just talking to my constituents, so give me a second. Mr. Chairman, yes, I'd like to move House File 231 laid over for possible inclusion to the Omnibus Higher Education Economic Development Finance Bill.
Thanks.
That's good.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have the great pleasure to speak on behalf of House File 31. It expands upon a very successful development partnership between the state of Minnesota and the Greater Minnesota Initiative Foundations. They were started in the late 80s in an effort between the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota to allow for planning on a regional basis. It's been very successful, leveraging these funds many times over, repeatedly reinvesting in our communities with that initial investment we made in the 80s. The initiative foundations are now coming to us asking for not even one-time money, but a loan to continue this process. What they would like to do is to take that loan and repay it over to the state of Minnesota, but using that loan to leverage additional investment opportunities through the initiative foundations around the state of Minnesota. They've guaranteed repayment of these funds, and we know based on their work in the past that we're going to get this money back. And in doing so, they will invest that several times over and again, making a great return on the investment for all of us taxpayers, but also for citizens and businesses, small businesses in particular, around the state of Minnesota. We allow for some local autonomy in that, but each region will do it in a manner that they think best suits the region. But for more details, I turn it over to John Ostrom, who's the Northwest Minnesota Foundation president and friend of mine.
Thank you, Representative Moe. Chairman Rukavina and members of the committee, my name is John Ostrom. I'm the president of the Northwest Minnesota Foundation. Our office is in Bemidji. Representative Moe explained that we're asking for a loan of $2 million to each of six MIFs, and we propose to make interest payments of 1% for 10 years and then guarantee a full lump sum repayment at the end of the term. We will use these funds to make investments in Greater Minnesota businesses, leveraging private investment and creating quality jobs. I think all of you know that the six Minnesota Initiative Foundations were created slightly over 20 years ago in partnership with the McKnight Foundation. We each have a community and economic development mission, and we received special IRS authorization in 1987 to make business loans as a charitable activity, and that began our partnership with the state. By the way, that's a unique function of foundations in this country. We're the only ones that can do that. Today, the collective assets of the six Minnesota Initiative Foundations are $275 million, and we've distributed about $250 million in loans to businesses and grants to nonprofits in Greater Minnesota over the past 20 years. Specifically, the collective impact of our business financing programs is noteworthy. We've made, and there is a handout that was presented that's got a little map on the top showing the Initiative Foundations. But we've made over 2,600 loans to rural businesses and entrepreneurs, totaling $150 million. This has leveraged $800 million in additional investment, or about a 1-to-5 ratio. And we've helped to create about 35,000 jobs throughout rural Minnesota. As Representative Moe indicated, we've had a strong partnership with the state of Minnesota going back to 1987 when the Rural Development Act created the Challenge Grant Program, first awarding each of us, the Minnesota Initiative Foundation, $1 million for business lending, and then in 1993 reauthorized that and provided an additional $1 million to each of us. In the year 2000, there was a rule change allowing repaid funds to remain with the Minnesota Initiative Foundation after having revolved once. The Challenge Grant Program funds have likely revolved 2 to 3 times, and virtually all of those dollars are still at work in Greater Minnesota. This funding is needed at this time for several reasons. We have all seen a significant change in gap financing need and activity over the past 20 years. For example, our average loan size has increased from $75,000 to $200,000. It just simply takes more capital to start or grow a business these days. Our level of participation in individual projects has increased because there are fewer alternative lenders than before. And probably most of all, there's a growing demand for more flexible capital, adaptable to new types of businesses. We need to provide assistance to businesses at different stages of growth, which could include microloans, equity capital, or near equity investments, as well as debt capital. Also, we found that it's difficult for financial institutions to finance intellectual property or specialized equipment, now common in the so-called knowledge economy. In summary, we're asking for a loan, not a grant. This is a business-like approach to providing capital to rural entrepreneurs to help them start up and expand. The Minnesota Initiative Foundations have a solid track record. Our performance demonstrates that we have confidence to make sound investments yielding high returns. This will improve the health of Greater Minnesota communities. Making business investments in the context of other community and economic development activities helps us to work with community leaders. This investment complements other economic development tools that the state has created. For example, the Job Z program, the Minnesota Investment Fund, various worker training programs. Finally, there will be a double bottom line. The funds will be repaid to the state with interest, with no administrative costs, producing sound results and accountability. The funds will help us meet business needs and thereby increasing the economic vitality of rural communities. You received a second handout, and I invite you to read about some of the businesses that we financed that have helped, that have grown and prospered throughout rural Minnesota. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I respectfully request your support of this legislation, and we'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Ostrom. Anybody have any questions? Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question, only a brag, I guess. On that handout, as you see, today's tackle listed, down at Beltrami, that's where I grew up.
Oh,
there used to be 100 people living there, and I left, and now there's 94. But that's a real success story. Thanks to your help.
Thank you. And Representative Moe, did you have someone else?
Not on this bill, Madam Chair. Just in conclusion, you also see on the handout, North Central Door, there's a recent ongoing expansion in Bemidji. Throughout Greater Minnesota, the work that are done is done by the Initiative Foundation and will be allowed to continue with this program. These are, as you know, real great living wage jobs in communities that don't have enough. And this will provide us with the opportunity to have more of them. Appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Moe. And thank you, Mr. Ostrom. All right, we'll move on to House File 281. If you would care to bring that one before us, please.
We've got a different set of testifiers here, Madam Chair, so changing the guard. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to move House File 281 to be laid over for possible inclusion also in the omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Moe. You can just go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, a few of you have heard this bill prior. As you know, many of you know, our regional development commissions are also a great planning institution that helps out local units of government throughout Greater Minnesota. In particular, transportation planning work can be very cumbersome with our local units of government not having the resources or the expertise necessary to actually accomplish those tasks without outside assistance. And we also don't want to force those local units of government to assess sufficient taxes in order to hire the staff that they might only need occasionally. This is House File 281 would provide for planning grants for local units of government, providing them with the tools they need, saving them tax dollars, using economies of scale to do things that we need them to do statewide without having to reinvent this infrastructure for every local unit of government. With that, I'd like to introduce John Schell, the Executive Director of Arrowhead Regional Development Commission, to tell us more about it.
Thank you, Representative Moe, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to discuss in a little more specific detail aspects of what this appropriation could do for smaller rural communities and townships throughout throughout Minnesota. But in so doing, I would like to represent those issues in northeastern Minnesota that we see coming before us that will undoubtedly also occur in other parts of the state. In this last year, and I think most of you are aware of it, we have about about $5 billion worth of proposed development in northeastern Minnesota. Those include major expansions of existing natural resource industries, mining, some new mining projects, as well as a coal gasification project and a proposed expansion of Blandon Paper Company in Grand Rapids. Now, in those communities surrounding those major investments, these communities are of a population size ranging from about 540 people at Taconite, Minnesota, to the real metropolitan areas of Virginia, which would have upwards of about 9,000 folks. In most of these communities in northeastern Minnesota, though, the questions regarding this kind of incredible growth that could occur have to do we have the capacity to accommodate in our transportation and our housing and indeed in the coordination of our land use and zoning ordinance between these communities to make sure that we have effective growth policies to accommodate this kind of expansion. This bill would help these smaller communities join together and work collaboratively with professional planners from the Arrowhead Regional Development Commission to ensure that we have the housing, the land use, and the transportation resources these communities need. But there are several other areas that we're working in now. These include housing. Recently, the Arrowhead Regional Development Commission had a request from six professional housing folks from around the region to become more actively involved in coordinating their efforts to provide low-income and workforce housing in northeastern Minnesota. Previous speaker mentioned gap financing. Well, it's also true in the housing market. In some cases, we have a difference of as much as $20,000 in value once a house is built in one of our smaller communities. The construction costs are actually higher than the value of the home once it's completed. We need to use the best we have in northeastern Minnesota in terms of our housing experts to provide multiple family, low-income single residential, and workforce residential housing. These programs exist in northeastern Minnesota, but not in a collaborative and coordinated way. And the kinds of dollars that we're talking about here would go to form a regional expertise that would allow these housing professionals from one community to work in another community, to allow folks that have expertise in multifamily to work outside their political boundaries in other areas of the region. It's an exciting concept, and it's one that our communities and our counties have asked us to do for them, and we can use these funds to do it. Two other projects. The U.S. Geological Survey, recently stated in a report, and I think this is relevant to all legislators because we have spent millions of dollars in geographic information system investments throughout Minnesota and for the most part with our state agencies. They are now suggesting that over 50% of those dollars that have gone into geographic information system investments are wasted. They're wasted because they have no ability to be used from one data set to another, from one unit of government to another, from one project to another. What they are suggesting is there has to be a way to make uniform GIS protocol for the communities that are using it. Well, in northeastern Minnesota, that's not difficult because we have so few technical experts that are available at the local level to allow our communities to use this incredibly effective technique for controlling development and developing good land use plans. With these dollars, we will be able to have a GIS professional staff that is available to local units of government throughout our region so that they, too, can take advantage of this powerful resource and utilize it in such a way that it's available to all other units of government in northeastern Minnesota. Finally, I'd just say, you know, we at local units of government level really do live in what we call a grantocracy. Most of our efforts on land use, on projects, are at the based on our ability to get a grant. But a grant doesn't build capacity. It's project-oriented, it's short-lived, and it doesn't allow for follow-through. Sure, we can compete against other NGOs, other units of government to try to find grants that local units of government in northern Minnesota can use, but quite frankly, that's not as effective as an ongoing capacity-building status that could be provided through this kind of a grant. It would mean for our local communities that they'll have professional planners that they don't have to keep on their payroll year-round, that they'll have technical assistance as they develop their geographic information systems, that they'll have someone that can help them and assist them coordinate their land use plans between communities, and fourth, that we have effective ways of dealing with the growth that's coming to northeastern Minnesota. Finally, I just simply say two things. One, the legislature does have expectations for local units of government. Throughout the state of Minnesota, you are asking those units of government to apply more effective, more sophisticated, and more complex land use controls in our shoreland areas. And yet you're asking them, and I say this with no disrespect, you're asking them to do that with property tax dollars, which are really generated after, quite frankly, the mistakes are made. With this kind of a grant, you can be assured that there will be technical land use assistance folks in each of our regions to accommodate the kinds of more sophisticated land use and natural resource planning that you expect from our local government officials. I'm pleased that it's linked to the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I think it's a good policy role for them to play to make us as regional development commissions accountable to them for these kind of planning efforts that we can undertake under this plan. I appreciate your time and would love to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions of Mr. Schell or questions of the author? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The gist of this bill is that you would work with other local government jurisdictions. Do local governments pay anything for this service? Tell us how that kind of is done.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, yes, they will. The bill provides for a local match that would be required, so it's one-to-one. That makes it more attractive and yet keeps them in the ball game because they've got some skin in the game. And to the local administrators that I've talked to with communities and townships, they're happy to do it that way.
Okay, Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just wondering, in terms of how do you go about hiring for that position?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
Representative Severson, sorry.
Excuse me. Representative Severson, yeah, on the pile.
Yeah.
Gee, there's more tonight? what we have tried to do, and it's been really a challenge for us, one of the criticisms of the Regional Development Commissions, quite frankly, is that it is difficult to have continuity of professional planners in the region because when we're living under a grantocracy, we can hire as long as we've got a grant to hire that person. What this does for us, of course, is to give us a longer-term opportunity to hire professionals and keep them employed in northeastern Minnesota or in other parts of the state as well. So the general fund grant would help us do that kind of hiring. We've had no trouble attracting good potential staff. The challenge really is to continue to keep them within our organization. This will help us do that.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions? Representative Welton? No? That was a no? Okay. Thank you very much, then. Thank you, Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Appreciate your support.
Representative Mahoney. House File 337, Representative Mahoney moves that House File 337 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education and Workforce Development Bill. Welcome
thank you,
to your own committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You took the ability for me to move my own bill, and I appreciate
that. Well, you moved
that.
It, so I just said the word.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. House File 337 asks for $1 million this year and $1 million next year for an acceleration program. This bill is something we've done in the past in similar fashion, requires no more than a limit of up to $25,000 in assistance for a small company to buy technology, and no more, that grant can pay for no more than 50% of the purchase. When a small company buys the technology to improve its business, it retains jobs in the state of Minnesota and increases the number of jobs that it has, whether it's in the state of Minnesota and hopefully in the smaller, more rural towns, but they're all over. They have 300 members in their association. I've got some testifiers that can speak a little bit more to it. I won't try to take up the committee's time because of the amount of rules that we have. I have three people, Kim Rotten, Brent Busman, and Maynard Ackerman. Mr. Chair, committee, I will introduce Kim Roden, and she will speak. She's the chair of Minnesota Technologies.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kim Roden. I know some of you, and it's nice to see some of you again. I'm going to try to make brief comments. I know you have a number of items before you. Just by way of background, I serve as vice president of Comcast Twin Cities Region. Also, since 2001, I have been on the board of directors of Minnesota Technology, and since July of 2004, I've been the board chair. Like you, I'm also an elected official, and part of my public service is to serve on the City Council in the City of Victoria. It's an honor to be with you today to ask for your support of House File 337, the Growth Acceleration Program. We refer to it as GAP. And GAP is a proposal, as you've heard, for a direct state investment of $2 million for the biennium to help small manufacturing companies that need assistance to grow their businesses. With your support of GAP, you will help your company constituents grow their businesses, and you will also be giving them additional opportunities to compete, grow, and continue their commitment as employers, job creators, and contributors to the economic heartbeat of local community life. Businesses qualifying for GAP grant dollars would include companies with employees of 100 or less and that are in a position to pay standard fees for business counsel and improvements. Many of MTI's business services staff tell me that these are the companies that they have to drive right on by right now as they head to companies that have the financial resources to pay for their services. And by way of background, I think some of you may have known, for those legislators who've been in state government, you may know that several years ago, Minnesota Technology used to get an annual appropriation from the state of Minnesota. When the state found itself on tough economic times, we were encouraged to transition from a free-to-fee environment. And so we are still providing services in outstate Minnesota to small manufacturers and technology companies. But instead of being able to do it free, we now have to charge for those services. We have a small percentage of businesses in the state of Minnesota who need this GAP funding in order to help pay for the services that would provide that bridge between standard pricing and what those companies can afford to pay. And so a factor that we believe reinforces the quality of the GAP bill is that MTI would be the organization to administer these funds, and we're the only statewide nonprofit that works exclusively with small manufacturing companies to help them with business solutions. I believe the results are fairly impressive. In 2006 alone, a federal independent survey found that among our 94 companies, MTI had helped them collectively increase and retain sales by over $50 million, save companies over $5.1 million in materials, energy, overhead, and other costs, as well as MTI creating and retaining almost 400 jobs. Almost three-quarters of the companies surveyed reside in Greater Minnesota, and as you may know, there is a particular appreciation for MTI's history of service in Greater Minnesota, where many companies haven't had the needed access to these business resources yet found MTI to be a valuable resource. A vote for GAB funding is also an important component in bolstering our ability to leverage federal dollars that come from the U.S. Department of Commerce's Manufacturing Extension Program. This long-standing cooperative agreement works solely to benefit small manufacturing companies. Many of you have small manufacturing and related companies in your districts which, for a variety of reasons, could benefit from GAP, the services, personnel, and expertise that we offer as MTI, and or we can leverage from a wide network of experts. Tonight, you will hear from two companies that MTI has had the honor of working with. They can share with you how MTI has created value for their respective companies and their communities, and they can also extol the virtues of MTI's ability to administer GAP funding should you approve our request. We remain vigilant in serving our public mission of providing small companies with competitive advantages that contribute to the growth of Minnesota's economic vitality. We believe that this GAP funding will further that mission and further Minnesota's relationship with its federal partners. Most importantly, this investment will help businesses with a needed infusion of vital financial resources and real-world business know-how to help implement technology and business improvements. Thank you for this opportunity to visit with you today. I'd like to call on, with the chairman's permission, Brent Bussman, who is the HR manager for Flow International of Hoyt Lakes and McGregor. And after he will make some very brief remarks, I'd like to know if it would be all right if we had Maynard Ackerman, who's the president of Ackerman, speak from Brownsdale, Minnesota, outside of Austin.
Sure, they came a long way.
Thank you.
I'll just one comment. I'm an honest committee and in the legislature long enough, and I think the only one here would remember would be Representative Clark when it was the Greater Minnesota Corporation and it got 60% of the lottery proceeds. Of
course, Mr. Chair, right away. Prior to the cutting that went on 4 years ago, the numbers, although impressive, Representative Gunther would remember the presentation made when we were trying to save this particular organization. Were off the charts. It really was so impressive that it was one of the things that Representative Gunther worked very, very hard to figure out a way to say. Can I get one of the pages to pass this out?
Yes. Nina, go ahead. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bussman. Nice to see you here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I drove down here to St. Paul, expressed my support of this GAP bill. Companies like mine throughout the state of Minnesota represent the economic engines that drive our economy here in Minnesota in the manufacturing sector. I work for Flow International. We have two locations. We have a location up in Hoyt Lakes, Minnesota that services the communities. We employ the people from the communities of Aurora, Biwabik, Gilbert, Eveleth, and Virginia. We also have a facility in McGregor, Minnesota. We employ 66 people there, drawing from many communities in the area of McGregor, Tamarack, Aiken, all the way as far west as Brainerd and as far east as Cotton, Minnesota. Our annual payroll runs about $4 million a year, and we have annual sales about $17 million. Manufacturers like Flow, we struggle to remain competitive in this market. When our budget process rolls around, we have to make hard choices, which usually rolls down to pay and benefits and training. And we have to retain these people that we have to build our communities, so we don't want to cut pay and benefits. So as much as I hate to say it, training is where it gets cut. A new way of doing business in the manufacturing industry is sweeping the country. I'm not sure if y'all are aware of it. It's called lean manufacturing. Its premise is to reduce waste in organizations. With this new philosophy, we've been able to reduce our finished goods and raw materials inventory by almost 60% just last year alone. How we got on the lean philosophy was through Minnesota Technologies. Mary Connor contacted me, and I said, we have this need. I don't know anything about it. Help us. She was instrumental in starting that and getting that off the ground, and we wound up saving, like I said, 60% or $3 million in finished goods and raw material inventory. So that's less finance charges that we have to pay, which means that we can use more of that money to get and retain good quality people. Again, Minnesota Technology has been instrumental in this process. They were the only organization that I found in Minnesota that could provide this lean training. So that tells me that MTI has its finger on the pulse of manufacturing, not only here in Minnesota, but globally. And, I hope you guys vote for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hold our questions if we have any. Mr. Ackerman, welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm glad to be here and to be able to speak about MTI and also this bill before you. My name is Maynard Ackerman. I'm president, CEO, owner of Ackerman Incorporated. We're a specialty manufacturer of microtunneling, tunneling, pipejacking equipment, and we're located in southeast Minnesota, about 10 miles northeast of Austin, a little town called Brownsville, 718 people. So,
he gets you to come up to the range?
Pardon?
Anything else on the range?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So we're probably not very well known. We're in a rural setting, but yet we operate globally. In fact, this past year, 20% of our sales were outside of the United States, and this year we're on track to do about 40% of our business outside of the borders of the United States. And most of our commerce actually comes from outside of the state of Minnesota. I'm a second-generation family-owned business. My father and mother founded this company in 1973. We employ today 67 employees. Last year we did $16 million in sales, and we're on track to do about $20 million this year. We have a lower number of employees than Flow International, but one thing that we do lean on heavily is our vendors. And I was really surprised. I'm driving up here. I had my controller do a search on our vendors. And these would be people that either supply us goods, services, whatever. And right now, this little company of mine, we have 1,246 vendors that are active. And of those vendors, 559 of them are within the state of Minnesota. So it kind of illustrates how one little company can, you know, touch other companies within our state or wherever. I have been involved with MTI longer, I think, than Flow, and I first heard of MTI, I think, back when they were the Greater Minnesota Corporation. I think they shortly after that changed to MTI. And at that time, I went to them in need of some money, equity financing, for a new product that we were trying to develop to compete globally. I was successful in getting this, and the money was welcome and very much needed to get this project off the ground. But what they provided for my company beyond the money was the expertise to help me, to guide me. At that time, my company employed about 20 people, and I didn't have, to say at least, I didn't have a clue. So what I know today versus what I knew back then, it's amazing that my company is still here today. But I had a lot of guidance and a lot of help, and I credit MTI as being a big part of that. Throughout the time, it was 1992 or 93 when I first approached them, I have since then used some of their products that they offer, and that GAP would provide funding for other companies, such as a financial review. We also had them involved with a software evaluation. And most recently, I'm looking also at the lean manufacturing and a business expansion, and I'm in need of some other experts to give me advice as to what to do. I also belong and have belonged to a group that MTI sponsors. It's called the Professional Business Advisor Group, and it's a group of us CEOs that get together and basically hear topics presented to us from MTI, as well as bring up concerns or problems that we're seeing that week, that month at our own business. In closing, I guess, and I know you're busy, I'd just like to say that a good illustration of what this program would do for my business and other like-sized businesses is about a year ago I attended a workshop put on by MTI where they were introducing my company and several other companies to lean manufacturing, which, by the way, I'm sold on. It's good for our companies. It's good for our country. And I attended this forum or this workshop with two of my other key employees, my my production manager and my operations manager, and it was interesting. We had a break and we talked to some of the other attendees, and there were three individuals from a much larger company there that were also just, you know, keeping up on what was going on. And one of these individuals actually had a business card that said he was director of lean manufacturing. Well, I can't afford a director of lean manufacturing. That's what this type of funding would make available to me, individuals or experts that I could bring into my business, unfortunately only for a short period of time, but at least for a period of time that I felt I needed. And I would be much more inclined to use her services if I could somehow make them be a little bit more affordable. Again, thanks for your time, and I would hope your support for this bill would be positive.
Question of any of the witnesses or the Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for any of the witnesses. Now, I can see the bill helps small manufactured businesses survive and help them with their technology and business improvements. Instead of having these businesses apply for these funds, because you're going to have winners and losers, there's some businesses won't be getting the money. Why not just propose a tax credit so that all manufactured businesses can take advantage of this type of funds?
Ms. Roden, do you want to handle that, or?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that would be a wonderful idea. What we have discovered in working with the roughly 7,000 manufacturers in Minnesota, 90% of whom have 100 employees or less, which is who this particular program would be geared to, is that in essence what we could do with this small grant program is multiply the investment the state makes many, many times over. I certainly would never say a tax credit wouldn't be a great idea, but what we've determined in working with a number of these companies throughout the state with our network of business consultants is that there is this group that with this small grant program would provide such a big return, and it's a targeted return, that we think that over a period of a year or two we could come back to you and say this is what we've learned and this is our success and our track record. At that point, you know, we might ask you for something different, but today what we've discovered the real need is this group that is not able to pay for services, and since we have transitioned from fee to fee, we do need to charge for our services now. And just to kind of illustrate that point, when we did lose our state funding a few years ago, and I want to thank Representative Gunther for the support he gave us with some transition monies at that time, we embarked on a number of efforts to raise revenue as MTI so we could continue our public mission of helping these companies. We even embarked on a charitable giving program where we called a number of companies that we had helped and we asked them if they might consider a small contribution to MTI to help us as we were rebuilding and re-engineering our organization. And I got the phone of one of these entrepreneurs, and he said, you know, Kim, I'd love to give MTI a charitable contribution, but I just took out a second mortgage on my home, and so did all the officers of my company to finance our expansion. So I kind of equate it to bacon and eggs. These entrepreneurs are making the contributions that the pig makes, not the contribution that the chicken makes. But certainly a tax credit is a great idea. I think it might be something we'd look at in the future, maybe not this year.
Representative Dammer, we're not the tax committee, but I was in the tax committee today watching all kinds of requests for you know, different tax benefits. So I think this is less expensive and helps directly, more directly to some of these programs.
If I could, I'd offer a comment on that, too. Sorry. When I first became acquainted with Greater Minnesota Corporation, I was skeptical. It was another state-run organization. No offense, but sometimes you look at these programs and you wonder if they're really generating good for whatever they were designed to do. And once I got involved with them, I could see that there was some real expertise. There were some good people involved. And what I have grown to appreciate about Minnesota Technology is that I find it a non-biased group of individuals that I can get information from that will steer me the right direction, and I trust them for that. Otherwise, if I'm looking, as I am right now, for plant expansion, it's difficult for me, especially in greater Minnesota, outstate Minnesota. I don't even know where to turn. I guess I could key it in on the internet, or I could go to the Yellow Pages, but I doubt that I could find that expertise, or at least a non-biased consultant that would steer me towards some product that he was selling. And I like the idea of a tax credit, but I would also like the idea of MTI still being around that I can have as my resource to go to when I need answers or at least direction on a difficult question.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I truly believe that Minnesota Technology has a great place in all Minnesota businesses, whether in the metro or greater Minnesota. But I look at the presence that they had and what they have today are completely different. Before, they would call on all businesses and see what their needs were. Today, they don't have the horsepower to do that. And I think they provide services that are well worth the money they charge. And I was going to ask both of the testifiers, had you known when you first met them what you know today, would you pay them what the fees were?
Can we have a short answer to that?
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Yes.
Good.
Oh, yes, without a doubt. And I'd also add that I think I'll be graduating from this group of manufacturers of 100 employees or less soon, and unfortunately probably won't be able to take part in this program, but I think it's for the right reason.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's the greatest statement you could have made. I look at what we're trying to do here is basically offer a scholarship to various industries that don't know, like you didn't know, what Minnesota Technology was worth. And it's a little something to get them over the hump so they get the needed things that you both got. So I appreciate them.
Okay, there are no further questions. Representative Mahoney, I would suggest maybe on your reporting on line 225 on the second page, 225, that since actually I don't know if we have jurisdiction, I guess we're referred to it, maybe you should clarify who they report to in the House and the Senate, then probably Representative or Senator Thomsoni's committee there and ours here, because nobody has Minnesota Technology anymore.
Mr. Chair, I can certainly take care of that at this.
Should we decide to do that, to do this, we can correct it when we,
sure, we
are putting the omnibus bill together.
Before we move it on.
With the, notice lately from the legislative auditor, all money goes out and doesn't get accounted for sometimes.
I just wanted to add in closing, before I ask to be considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill, is that it's approximately, for this kind of money, they say 400 jobs, retain or create 400 jobs in a year. Almost any of our other job creation or job training programs spend that or less. And this is a true partnership with government and private industry. And I certainly hope that the members of the committee and the chair understand how important this is. So, again, with that, I'll move for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, Mr. Chair.
And we've had that motion, and we're putting it now aside for inclusion. And we'll probably have to fix up the language on the grant itself directly to Minnesota Technology. Probably go through deed, maybe. Okay, thank you very much, all of you, for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Member
House File 1374, for Representative Ansel's. Representative Moe moves House File 1374 be recommended to pass and be held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education Workforce Development Bill. Representative Anzelt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Over to Coxley. Welcome.
Thank you. Follow.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is House File 1374. If I could get a motion.
I made the motion.
Oh, you made the motion.
Yes, okay. I mean, Representative Mo made the motion.
Okay. Sorry. Thank you. Joining me at the table is Mary Matthews from the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund. a fund that has been in existence in northeastern Minnesota since 1989. This bill requests an appropriation to be made to the Department of Employment and Economic Development for $500,000 for a grant to the Entrepreneur Fund for technical assistance and small business training for new and emerging businesses. As I said, this fund has been around since 1989. It has a good track record, and Mr. Chairman, I'm sure you got a chuckle when you saw my name as the chief author of a good business bill. But it is because this is a very effective small business diversification job creation fund that I wholeheartedly support and know a little bit about over my years in northern Minnesota. Since 1989, this fund has helped start or stabilize or expand over 900 small businesses. It's helped to create or retain 2,300 jobs in northeastern Minnesota. And its loans have totaled about $6.5 million. And what's more important than that is this fund leverages additional financing from both public and private sources. And lastly, Mr. Chairman and members, almost 8,000 citizens have benefited from the business training and the technical assistance services provided through Ms. Matthews and the fund. And with that, we'll stand for questions.
Ms. Matthews, welcome to the committee. Would you like to put in your... Representative Anzell forgot to let you testify, so I will.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to speak today on behalf of this bill. Northeastern Minnesota needs jobs and tax base to enhance its quality of life. And even with the potential of large mining and paper and energy projects on the horizon, we can't lose sight of the need to diversify our economy and to develop locally owned businesses and our entrepreneurial talents. As Representative Anzell pointed out, the Entrepreneur Fund has a 17-year history of working with both startup and existing businesses in our region. In your packet is a copy of our newsletter, and there's three stories in that newsletter. One about the Plum Bun Bakery in Ely, Firelight Gallery in Virginia, and Driven Vision in Duluth. And these businesses are representative of the over 900 businesses that we've worked with through technical assistance, training, or financing since we started in 1989. Our request for funding from you this year has two parts. The first part would provide intensive training and technical assistance to 50 new and existing small businesses in the region to help them access financing, either debt or equity financing through the Entrepreneur Fund and other sources. In our experience, tying technical assistance with financing increases the potential that these small businesses will succeed. Our historical perspective is that about 94% of the businesses that we finance are still in business 2 years later. The second half of our request would help launch a regional effort called the Northland Entrepreneur Development System. This is a regional initiative led by the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund with over 30 economic development and education partners. This is a 10-year strategy that we hope to launch in July that would change how we as a region grow and nurture entrepreneurial talent. This entrepreneur development system has three parts. It first focuses on education and culture to create a supportive environment for entrepreneurship and to change community attitudes and to introduce entrepreneurship to youth as an alternative to employment. The second element is to create a service provider network that would network existing public and private service providers to create efficiency for both entrepreneurs as well as service providers and ensure that entrepreneurs are getting the right service at the right time for the right price. The third element would be to create a professional business coaching network to provide professional and accountable professional business coaching for entrepreneurs in our region who are choosing to grow. The funds that are requested under this bill would provide professional business coaches for 30 entrepreneurs. As a result of these, both of these efforts, we expect to see changes in the skills of the entrepreneurs in our region. We would create companies that create jobs, increase their revenue, and find new markets. We would see increases in individual and community wealth, changes in our environment, in our support for entrepreneurs, and a systems change that would create more efficient use of existing business development resources. In the Entrepreneur Fund's experience, we see a minimum of 2.5 jobs created by each business. We would serve 80 businesses under this project, and we would see a leverage of at least 2-to-1 to the state investment with federal and foundation dollars. I would ask your support for this bill and would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions of Representative Anvelt or of Ms. Matthews. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Matthews, isn't basically this what all initiative funds do for their areas?
This Ms. Matthews. Representative Gunther, the initiative funds are providing, it's my understanding of the initiative fund efforts, they're creating a finance pool. We're asking for technical assistance money that would help businesses access funding from us and from the initiative fund. In northeastern Minnesota, the Northland Foundation does primarily much larger loans. Our loans tend to be very small. Our small loans average under $8,000. Mr. Ostrom had indicated a larger loan size of $200,000 as an average loan size. There are some initiative funds that do microlending. As a general rule, we're the microlenders in northeastern Minnesota.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Mary, thank you. Oh, excuse me. Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Chair. I just wondering what kind of a balance you have in the account. How many dollars are in your fund right now? You keep a running balance.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund has a loan pool of about $3.5 million. That has been derived from the U.S. Small Business Administration, USDA Rural Development, and a number of foundations. We have about $1 million available to lend. We have, over our history of making loans, we've charged off about 3% of the loans that we've made. And we have, in the last 3 or 4 years, we have an annual charge-off rate of about 1% or less.
That's pretty impressive, actually. Okay. No further questions then of the witness or Representative Anzell. Thank you very much. We'll hold your bill over for possible inclusion then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay. Representative Mariani, House File 826. Members, this bill may have a little bit of questions on it. And that's Representative Mariani. What I'm going to do is you come down, and I'm going to give you what time you think you need, and then I want the opposition to come down, and I'm going to give them, the opposition can testify first, I guess, or do you want the pros to testify first? Those in favor.
Pros are fine.
Okay. Well, it looks like they're lining up, so we'll do that. And I want to try to limit testimony to about 3 minutes each. So even though some of these guys are bigger than me, I think I... Not this gavel right here. So. Okay, welcome to the committee. Representative Mahoney moves to House File 826. Be recommended to pass and refer to the House floor, members. I don't think there's a fiscal note on it. It's going right out of here. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'll be real brief. I even rolled out my script just to make sure I'll be real brief. So I'll do that. I'll turn it over to these gentlemen to explain what we're trying to do here. For 100 years, members of St. Paul Ford Auto Plant produced great vehicles that generated solid economic benefit not only to my city, but to the East Metro and to the state of Minnesota. Decent jobs with good wages resulted for literally thousands of Minnesotans helping to fuel our local economy. With the recent announcement that the plant will be shut down in the near future, an uncertain future awaits the workers and our local economy. While Ford Company and the City of St. Paul have admirably moved forward to plan for a new future, many workers are concerned that a dismantling of the plant and the selling off of key assets, most notably members, the energy generating power plant, may remove some of the options from the table and limit future manufacturing possibilities. So, Mr. Chair, House File 826 will require the owners to maintain the plant in a condition fit to be sold for 2 years after its current use is discontinued. Our hope is that among the choices available for the community is the ability to seek a new manufacturing operator. Now, the logic is that the current plant employs workers at very decent wage levels that I think we should try to perpetuate if at all possible. We're always looking to create jobs, always looking to create good jobs. An early dismantling of the plant could preclude manufacturing possibilities that would benefit our local economy. Given the interest that many of us in this body have had in most recent years and months in green energy production, green vehicle production, and related industries, I think it would be to our benefit to have that option doable in a plant that currently already produces vehicles and that has access to an energy production source. So members, it's straight up, Bill, that's my intent as the author. I'll let you hear from the workers in terms of their intent and their approach.
Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Chairman.
Identify yourself and just go ahead.
I am Bob Flynn. I am the Secretary Treasurer for United Auto Workers Local 879. When I left for work early this morning, I did not know I'd be testifying before your fine committee. My job today was to try and get caught up on an activity report, which is a report generated by the Ford Motor Company that tracks employees leaving and joining the company. I am 3 weeks behind on that report. Over 900 of my brothers and sisters have been relieved of duty from the Ford Motor Company since December 14th. Many of these members I know personally. Many of them I know their families. And if they live in South Washington County, I or one of my other co-workers probably coach their baseball team or a soccer team. We're very active in our community. We are a family at the Ford Motor Company. When Ford announced plans to close our plant in April of 06, our workforce was not only stunned, they were disappointed. We were a top quality plant, second only to the Japanese, who build a fine product. Our productivity was some of the best in the United States, and our workers were disappointed. It seemed like there was a rush by city leaders to develop the property on top of our jobs. A lot of our members were quite frankly very angry, approached myself and my local union president, Roger Trevine. What can we do? How can we save some jobs at this facility? We were reminded of some legislation that was done on the Iron Range, and my friend Stan will talk to that effect, about how a plant or a number of plants were saved from demolition just for the sole purpose of someday in the future putting jobs in there. Our goal with this bill is quite simply we want to keep that plant there with the power plant intact to have some sort of an industrial site in the city of St. Paul that would be second to none in the United States. The power would be green power generated by a facility on the river with four completely refurbished generators. And we think this would be a state-of-the-art facility, and that's the sole purpose of our legislation tonight, is to make some sort of an industrial site there where UAW, along with the steel workers and our friends in the Teamsters, could organize and represent workers and keep some industrial jobs in the city of St. Paul instead of just continually watching them leave.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll hold off on questions until they're all done. Mr. Daniels, welcome to committee. Identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stan Daniels. I work for United Steelworkers. I'm their political director, and I also am the vice president of the Industrial Union Council, which represents six unions and about 43,000 members, and we passed a resolution supporting to keep the Ford plant going. The reason I'm here is because we've had similar actions taken on the Iron Range. We lost two plants, two, maybe three, were saved because of this legislation that somebody from the Iron Range has had the wisdom to write. A good friend of ours.
You're pretty smart when you're in front of this committee, aren't you?
It was Representative Rukavina, who, you know, we're from the Iron Range, even though he's not in my district. They're all our legislators, because we, one, take care of all. So, but anyway, the reason this legislation was presented, because we had a plant in Nashwauk, Minnesota, called the Butler plant, and the owners in that plant decided that they it was a good product, very good ore. They decided they just wanted to, one of the owners wanted to take it down and write it off as a tax write-off. And so within months, they dismantled that plant, demolished it, made millions of dollars. So we could see the writing on the wall. We talked to our legislators, and they come up with this idea that we could put a legislative in store, and if any place up there was going to, any plant, industrial, taconite plant, was going to shut down and tear down, they had to keep it operational for 2 years. During that time, we've saved National Taconite. Just recently, we saved Evola Taconite, the plant that I worked at for 31 years. They shut down for 9 months, and if we wouldn't have had this bill, they probably would have dismantled it. But now it's going, full production, full wages, union jobs, and it's a good site. The one I talked about earlier at Butler Taconite, that's the site where right now you have Minnesota Iron and Steel wanting to build the taconite plant. If we would have had this language and kept that operational for 2 years, it probably still would be running, and we would just be adding a steel mill on it instead of building the whole place back up for $2 billion. So this legislation is good, and I think the workers there deserve a chance to try to get another industry in there, and I think that's all the legislation asked for. We've saved many jobs and many in the industry on the Iron Range. Thanks for that wisdom of that bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gertesmeyer. Welcome.
Chairman Rukavina, that was a nice ring to it. Chairman Rukavina, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gertesmeyer, and I work for Teamsters Joint Council 32. We represent all of the Teamsters in the state of Minnesota, Iowa, and North and South Dakota. I, along with Bob Killeen, got a call forenoon today asking if I could come down and lend our voice to my brothers and sisters in the UAW and their plea to you for help and trying somehow to save or help save their jobs, if there's a way to do that. In my long career with the Teamsters, I've had the good fortune to be principal officer of the Teamsters Local for 24 years. I can tell you without any doubt that there's nothing harder for a labor leader to handle than when a employer closes and you have people out of work, and some of them have been working for a very long time. The bigger the unit, the bigger the problem, and all of the associated problems that go with that, the loss of wages, pension, health, and welfare, we all know about that. But it is an excruciatingly difficult problem for labor leaders to take a look and see if there isn't something that can be done. I really urge you to take a look at this. There's got to be a way that we should not close off until it's absolutely necessary this many jobs and these high quality jobs. We know what's happening to our jobs. A lot of them are going overseas, and we may have an opportunity here to do something, and if we just don't rush into things too greatly. So again, we're glad to add our voice to that of UAW and ask you for a little bit of consideration on House File 826. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gertesmeyer. Members, would you like to hear from the other side, and then we'll open it up for questions?
Sure.
Fine. Okay. Thank you. Why don't we have the three in opposition, sir, and then
We'll get you down here and ask anybody else in the audience if they're for or against it. I'm assuming if you just want to sit down, sir, and all three of you come to the table and identify yourselves and just go ahead then. And I'll lay the same ground rules. We keep it to about the same timeline as the proponents, but thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good evening. My name is Cecile Bedore, and I'm the Director of Planning and Economic Development for the City of St. Paul. And thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you tonight. While some may view the closing of the St. Paul Ford plant as an unfortunate result of market forces, I want to echo Mayor Coleman's appreciation of how tragic this closing is to all the UAW members, workers, and their families. Ford has been a good neighbor and a good corporate citizen of St. Paul. We believe, like us and the workers, that they'd like nothing more than to be in the position of expanding production instead of scaling back. We also believe that the local UAW 879 members have worked very hard to try to prevent this closing as well, coming up with innovative ideas to help Ford remain competitive. They took the lead, for example, on securing funds for a new training center, ultimately providing robotics training for their workers, which thus ensured a higher level of skill among their plant employees. They also negotiated a one-of-a-kind alternative work agreement of 4 10-hour days. This arrangement allowed Ford to sell the power generated by the hydro plant back to the grid at peak prices on Fridays, thus creating an income stream for the company. Unfortunately, these and other efforts simply could not turn the tide of the economy and the industry. And while everyone in the mix would prefer to have this plant remain open, providing good-paying jobs, we feel we have to acknowledge the fact that the plant will be idled in September of 2008 and possibly closed if the UAW National agrees to do so. And we believe it's imperative to start that planning now to ensure quality reuse of the site as soon as possible after the plant closes, again, if it does close, and ensure that that reuse includes good-paying jobs. Any delay will delay the creation of new jobs and will delay the creation of tax base for the City of St. Paul. I'd like to take just a minute to walk through our planning process with you. Upon notice of the closing by Ford, we immediately engaged Ford in discussions. We shifted gears to planning for the reuse of the site once it became clear that Ford was indeed going to idle the plant. And we did that in an effort to ensure, again, that any reuse would include shifting jobs and an increase in our tax base. Ford agreed with us to pursue a community engagement and planning process and worked with us to develop one that would meet the goals of Mayor Coleman. First and foremost, the creation of new, good-paying jobs in that site to try to replace those that had been lost. Innovative design, mixed use, connectivity to the river, sensitive to the surrounding land uses in the community, and a project that could serve as a national model for green and sustainable design. The City Council passed a resolution requesting the Planning Commission to establish and appoint the task force. With the charge that was put forth, and you have was one of your handouts, the charge that was developed for the task force. Our Planning Commission Chair Brian Olson received over 100 applications, which is fairly unprecedented for a planning process of this type. Unfortunately, we did not receive any applications from the UAW members, I think, through miscommunication, but our Planning Commission Chair Brian Olson has agreed to appoint a UAW member to the task force. I should note as well that a UAW member has been attending all the task force meetings to date. In order to ensure the integrity of the process, the city has retained an experienced planning consultant to facilitate the development of the land use plan. If you look on the second page of your handouts, which has the map, you'll see that our goal for developing the 3 to 5 development scenarios will be done by the end of June. Ford will take it from there and conduct an AUAR, which is an alternative urban area-wide review, the results of which will be a recommendation and selection of a preferred development scenario, and then ultimately a change in the zoning and comprehensive plan. While this is certainly an aggressive timeline for planning of this scale, we believe it can be done and that the entire process will be complete so that once the plant is sold, the developer can move forward to quickly implement the plan rather and restore jobs and tax base. While we certainly share the UAW's goal of increasing the number of manufacturing jobs in the city, it is difficult for us to support a temporary moratorium on the sale of the plant for the following reasons. First, the timing. As I've just noted, we are on schedule to have the zoning changes completed by September 2008. A moratorium would prohibit a sale until mid-2009, which could mean an even longer delay before any new jobs or tax base are realized on this site. Those that need jobs in the city of St. Paul are not in a position to wait. Second, our process will ensure that any new development meets the city's and community's objectives for the site, which again includes good paying jobs. Ford has had and will continue to have many suitors purchase the site, and we want to keep Ford engaged as well and at the table together with any developer that may come through. Finally, if such a moratorium isn't active, Ford could choose to walk away from the table and not engage in this planning process at all. And in 2009, simply sell the property to the highest bidder. The city would then need to start over on a zoning and planning process, again delaying the creation of any new jobs in that space. The city has been quite aggressive now to ensure a positive redevelopment outcome. We are the only city in the country that has engaged Ford in such a process, and others are taking note of our efforts. I was just interviewed, for example, by the National Real Estate Investor magazine because of the assertiveness of the city and the unique approach we're taking. We encourage the work that's being done now to investigate potential buyers who may choose to utilize some or all of the plans, and we would like the task force to have this information for consideration. While many would argue that the reuse of the actual facility is highly unlikely, there may be a real possibility of this, and the task force determines that the entire site should remain manufacturing, then that will be the recommendation. My point is that a temporary sale moratorium is not necessary in order to consider these various opportunities. We believe this task force is a vehicle to get all the hopes and dreams and ideas on the table, resulting in a positive outcome. This development that we envision will include good-paying jobs and modern, cutting-edge urban design. We want to get back to this work and get it right on track so that we can get new jobs on that site as quickly as possible once this plant closes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Whoever wants to go next, you will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, my name is Pat Harris. I am a member of the St. Paul City Council, and I represent the area in which the Ford plant is right now. I want to recognize the people from the UAW and their supporters from the Teamsters for all the work that they've done, for their incredible support of that plant and their support of our community for roughly 70 years. We have coexisted with that plant in our neighborhood, and the plant has been very beneficial to our city, as I indicated, for over 70 years. And they have been not only just a great provider of jobs and tax base, but they've been a great neighbor for those of us who live in that neighborhood. I would also like to recognize Bill Rooney, who is here from the Ford plant. We have engaged Ford in the process, the planning process, and they have been an excellent partner, and we look forward to working with them in the future. As a strong supporter of brevity, I will indeed be brief. I would just like to indicate my strong support for the words of Ms. Bedore, and that the city would like nothing more, absolutely positively nothing more, than to see Rangers being built at that site. When Mr. Gertesmeyer indicated how difficult it is when a plant closes, that was also difficult for those of us who represent our community. As I indicated, Ford has been a fantastic partner. But given the state of the auto industry, our community absolutely positively needs to prepare for the future. We want to bring good-paying jobs into our community, but we believe a moratorium works against that purpose. A moratorium means that all plans to redevelop the site and all the work that we're doing, including preparing for 21st century manufacturing, grinds to a halt. We don't want that to happen in St. Paul. We want to move forward to bring good-paying jobs into our community. Ultimately, we believe the city is the appropriate government entity to gather public input, study, discuss, plan, negotiate, and ultimately execute a plan towards the goal of preparing the site for future use. We didn't want to see the plant close, but our community, as a community that believes in our neighborhoods, we can believe in a tax base, we need to plan for the future. So I'm here to support the mayor and to support our community in trying to bring good jobs, but not letting that process try and go halt. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Moeller. For 49 years, I've been a resident of Highland Park, and I'm CEO of Abarak Moeller Jeweler, a family-run jewelry store that's been in business in the Highland area for 55 years. We have three locations, one in St. Paul's Island Village, which I said, which is just a stone's throw from the Ford plant, one in Minneapolis and another anytime. I'm also a member of the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce and chair of its Ford Sites Business Advisory Group. With there being many members, new members of the legislature, I'd just like to take a moment to tell you a bit about the chamber. St. Paul Area Chamber has nearly 2,200 members. It's Minnesota's largest local chamber. Its primary service area includes not only St. Paul, but many communities in the East Metro area. The chamber is a very active member of the community and takes a lead role representing the voice of its members wherever appropriate. As such, we work with the Highland Business Association to convene the Ford Site Business Advisory Group to provide a business perspective on the future development of the site. We, like others, were deeply disappointed with the news of the Ford plant closure. I was especially disappointed by the closure since I have many customers who work on the line as well as in management at the plant. And in fact, we agree with the goal of the bill, which is to keep jobs in the city. But the tactic, state legislation, is simply the wrong way to go about reaching this goal. Times change, the marketplace changes, we have to adapt. Because of the closure, there is an opportunity for redevelopment that is rarely seen at this scale in an urban area should Ford choose to sell the land. At this point, we need to keep all options available. Passing legislation that requires Ford to keep its plant in operating condition for 2 years will stall efforts at finding the next highest and best use of the property. We need to start planning now so development can move forward in a timely manner when and if Ford sells. Generally, the Chamber believes that moratoriums are not good public policy. Such actions do nothing more than postpone the inevitable and sends a very negative message to potential developers and job creators. We also need to respect the rights of the landowner. This legislation, if passed, would tie the hands of Ford, a result that usually does not sit well with citizens who have historically strongly valued the rights of property owners. For these reasons, the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce stands in opposition to this bill. We urge you not to move the bill forward. Let the marketplace do its job. Thank you for allowing me to appear here tonight. I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Okay, let's start with questions, for these folks first, if you want, and then for the proponents. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And here's what I'm having a problem with. It seems that your argument is premised on the fact that if there's a two-year moratorium, you can't engage the planning process. But, like, are you saying that because the plant is operating and standing there or in operating condition, the city is frozen and afraid to do something? Or, I could use other words, but that does not make sense. I mean, if the plant is operating, you can have your 24 members board make all the plans in the world. And even if they make great plans, tell me, what's the hook that keeps Ford from saying, nice plans, talk to you tomorrow, I'm going to sell the plant today? It's two questions.
Councilman Harris, maybe you can take that since you're the elected official. I would like to say one thing, though. I got a bill coming up where I want to make Rangers, too, just a different kind of Rangers. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I think those are excellent comments. We believe that slowing the planning process down just delays what is going to be the addition of jobs into our community. We could plan, and we could probably wrap up the zoning in a 60 to 90 day period right now, but that wouldn't actually make sense until the plant is actually being closed, so the property is actually being dispensed, and we can find out what the new owner, who the new owner is, and how we can work through that process. And we could rezone it one way, and a new owner could buy it and take it in an entirely different direction, and we would delay that process for a long time. Now, I think that's more of a side thing than it is really just the fact that we want to get moving on adding jobs in our community. Yes, we'd like to be producing automobiles, but we don't see that as a market reality right now, and that's unfortunate for all of us. But we want to move forward, get those jobs there, and finish this process. And we could zone it, like I said, in 90 days, but that wouldn't be a responsible planning process.
Representative Mahoney, anything else?
I'm going to argue here with my friend, but I get to see, and when we go grocery shopping on a regular basis, and we commiserate about the joys of elected public officials. The plant, you have no clue whether the plant is polluted or not. So even if Ford does decide to sell the plant tomorrow or close the plant tomorrow, how many months is it going to take you to figure out if it's polluted or not? And back to your original answer to my first question, that doesn't make any sense. You can zone it for residential, you can zone it for industrial, you can zone it for light commercial. You can make any zone you want, and you said yourself, you could change it in a heartbeat. And I've never seen a community planning organization come through with a plan in less than a year or 18 months to begin with, so you're only 6 months out. And I've sat on more than my share of community planning. So, for the first question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, we can see each other in the grocery store. I'm sure this will be a new topic of conversation next time.
No,
that's a good idea. We need to plan. When we do a plan process in the city, it'll be done on the market realities of today. We don't want to engage the planning process today on something that's going to happen a couple of years from now. And plus, I think the reality is that Ford appears to be headed down the path of closing the plant. And what we're going to have there is an idle plant for 2 years, 2 to 3 years, when we have an opportunity, because as Mr. Mueller has indicated, and because of what we all know in terms of the viability of that site from a national perspective, that we're just going to be delaying what we hope is good manufacturing jobs and possibly residential and possibly other things that we know we can get now. And so I don't see that there's a reason for us to wait on that process when we can start it right now and try to replace some of these jobs. I mean, I think Mr. Gertesmeyer and everybody else are absolutely right. I mean, we've got a problem. And I want to have that opportunity rather than wait 2 years to do it.
Representative Mo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got a map in front of me you handed out, similar to one up here. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at it, looking at Ford Parkway going across from the bridge to Cleveland Avenue and south. Maybe you could tell us, I know the answer to this, by the way. The development along Ford Parkway and then around that, what's the surrounding use of the land there? And how might, I'll just say my question now, how might that affect what the development's going to be? Should we proceed? And then what might the wages be for those jobs if that development remains consistent with the current development on Ford Parkway in Cleveland Avenue?
Ms. Bedard, would you be the one to answer that maybe, or who?
I think I'm going to defer to Councilmember Harris since he lives in the neighborhood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, that's a great question. I live about four blocks from the Ford site, and surrounding neighborhood is also a very old and solid St. Paul neighborhood. It is a mixed-use development, mostly residential with some retail. The mayor's goal, and it's a goal that I share, is to try to maintain some level of manufacturing at that site. I mean, clearly, the neighborhood can't support the traffic implications of a fully residential neighborhood there or a fully retail environment there. So our focus from a neighborhood perspective and from a business and tax-based perspective is to try to get some jobs in there, and we hope they're high-paying jobs. It's always difficult to match the scale that Ford was paying, but we're going to try. I mean, we think, as everybody has indicated, that due to the location, the city's interest, the state's interest, the potential use of power that might be available, I think we're going to have an opportunity to replace those jobs, but we need to start that process now so I can get it done.
Mr. Chairman, our committee shares your goal of replacing that with good-paying jobs, and we want to help you to do that. That's why we have a moratorium here, perhaps, to make sure that there's industrial jobs actually go there. I mean, I know I shop there, when I have to stay down here on the weekend, and there are retail jobs mostly there. I mean, those people probably make more retail there than where I live in Bemidji, but still, we're $8-$9 an hour. I mean, what's the average salary at the Ford plant or an industrial job down here? I'm guessing it's a good bit better than that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have the pay scale, but I would guess you're absolutely right on that. But that's exactly what we want is those types of jobs there. And we just believe from a market reality, an economic reality in Minnesota and in America today, that a single plant user is not the highest likelihood. If that comes along in our process, and if we can maybe facilitate that, that would be fine if it fits into the neighborhood use. Ford is very unique in that it was a major Midwestern industrial plant that didn't really impact the neighborhood other than in a positive way. And we would hope that if there was a single source user there, that it would be able to do that as well. But we're looking at market realities, and we think it's going to be multiple industries.
The other Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a pro and con on this. Not necessarily a question, but if a plant is maintained, there's a better chance that another company would invest in it and bring jobs and revenue to the state. That's the pro that I see in this situation. The con is if a company is looking for such a plant to buy now, they too would have to maintain the plant for 2 years if they discontinued operations if this bill was passed. They may not risk the money in Minnesota, which already doesn't have a good reputation for business climate. So if maintaining the plant benefits the state and not the private company, the state should pay the maintenance. So that's just the pros and cons.
Well, Representative Detmer, where do you get your information that we don't have a good business climate? I hear that often from your side of the aisle. So
Mr. Chair, he might have gotten it from all those Fortune 500 companies that are located in the country.
Maybe you can answer that while you're talking here, because people throw that statement out, and there's not only no documentation, I think the statistics show from the federal government that we create more jobs in Minnesota than any other state in the Midwest. So do you have some source that, or Representative Severson is your source? He's raising his hand. Representative Detmer, do you have a source for that thing?
Just what I've read.
From the handwritten note from Representative Severson? Or
no, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Representative Severson.
To that point, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I didn't pass him a note. He is learning quickly. But I think the issue, and we talked about this on the House floor 3 years ago when we were talking about some of these economic incentives, and that's the corporate tax rate of Minnesota, 2 to 3 points higher than our surrounding states. We can't compete at that level. And if you take a look at just the taxpayer composition on there's a particular site that I go to. But the bottom line is, in terms of...
Count Royce Limbaugh, okay.
The bottom line is, our tax incentives are abysmal for businesses in Minnesota. And for the tax advantages, and I apologize because I don't have the book with me, but I'll bring it next time. But this kind of speaks directly to the thing that we're talking about here today. How do we create a business-friendly environment? Particularly, there's huge differences between the range and St. Paul. I would say the cost of land and the cost of owning a house down in St. Paul are probably 2 to 3 times that of the range. So I think there's...
Depends if you're on Lake Vermilion or not.
Well, that's true. Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I think the issues that we're talking about are apples and oranges. If we're talking about the state subsidizing a plant to be held for a couple of years here while prospective business people come down, that's like talking about pushing the smoking ban 2 years back. You know, the people that are going to be looking at this thing, are going to say, well, when do we get a chance to bite at the apple? And if we say you're 2 years out, they're going to say, we're going to go someplace else where we can see some actual revenue changeover. So I have kind of begged the question here, Mr. Chair, but the bottom line is, Minnesota is not a very friendly place in terms of tax policies for our businesses.
Well, again, Representative Severson, I don't know where you're citing those figures, because we have more Fortune 500 companies than our neighbors, and we have more job growth expansion than our neighbors in the Midwest, and those are figures that come out of the Bush administration. No, those aren't my figures. So.
No, and Mr. Chairman, I would agree with that, and I think that's in due in large part to the job Z zones that we implemented 3 years ago.
Oh boy, everybody deserves the right to be wrong once in a while. Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you see any opportunity for a middle ground between your vision of the termination of the planning process at the time of the close of the Ford plant and the vision putting forward by the United Auto Workers, Steel Workers, and Teamsters to maintain it as a large manufacturing site. Is there a compromise in allowing some flexibility in the timeline, including them more aggressively in the planning process and aggressively pursuing some of the opportunities that they're looking at?
Ms. Bedard, do you want to take that one?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we've talked about is the work that the FAB Task Force, Plug-in Hybrid Energy Vehicle Task Force, is doing in terms of looking at green manufacturers or other automobile manufacturers that have come in. That's exactly the type of information that we would like to have our task force have in terms of their deliberations. So we're really not at odds in terms of what we're trying to achieve here. It's just a different way of going about it. But certainly, if there's more time that is needed in terms of our planning process to bump that out a couple of months in order to ensure that we get all that information in that process, absolutely, we absolutely can. I think our feeling is that we are just really, our goals are not different. It's just a different manner of going about them, and we really do welcome all the input that we can get, particularly on the creation of jobs. You know, when we're talking about what those wage rates will be, our goal, again, is exactly what the UAW goal is that the highest manufacturing jobs that we can get is what we want. The mayor has made it very clear that he does not want a bunch of retail jobs on that site that pay $8 an hour. That's just not going to cut it in terms of what his goals are for that site. So I do think there's some way for us to work together.
So are they now at the table as partners with you, the United Auto Workers, the Steel Workers, the Teamsters?
Well, as I said, as I said in my remarks, they were not appointed by our planning commission to the task force because we have a process that we need to go through and people need to apply, and unfortunately there was no application. Our planning commission chair has agreed to enlarge the task force so now to include a UAW worker, and one of the members there has been attending all the task force meetings. I've been talking with them regularly, taking tours of the site, so there has been ongoing dialogue since the beginning of the month. So.
Okay. Other questions of these folks? Are there questions? Did you have a follow-up?
Well,
go ahead.
I do, but it's to Representative Mariani, if you'll allow me.
Representative Mariani and any of the other witnesses previously, you're entitled to ask questions, of course. Representative Brandon,
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Representative Mariani, in light of the questions I was raising, I'm wondering if you see any room for, you know, a possibility of holding over this bill and having some discussion between the parties about a compromise position that would allow some flexibility in the timeline and make labor feel an active part of the, make them actually an active part of the process. Is there a middle ground here?
Representative Breiner, it's not my intention to hold this bill over. I think it's the intention to move the bill on, and then there can be some discussion and compromise and between the proponents and the opponents of this legislation, if it gets out of this committee this evening. I think, you know, Representative Mariani, I'm sure, has always been a uniter and a compromiser, and I have full faith in him that if we get it out of here, he's going to work with people. But I don't know if you want to lay it over and wait to work with people, or what's your wish?
Mr. Chair, members, I would like to move forward with this, and I should just sort of full revealing, you know, that some of the original thoughts were to have this thing held off for 5 years, and I said, no, absolutely not. Members, what's on the table here is, in my mind, not inconsistent with the very proactive efforts that the city's going forward with. I applaud my city for doing that. This is really simply making sure that all our options remain on the table. If you look at this picture, the picture's worth a million words. I mean, where else in the state do you have the confluence that you see here? You've got an energy, a green energy source with the river. You've got the falls there. You've got the plant there. You have pre-existing use. All we're saying is, let's keep that on the table. Let's not have this be cannibalized. And then 6 months, 12 months, whatever, 18 months down the line, our options have been limited because the facility has been cannibalized. So members, you know, Representative Denver, in your defense, I think you did have it right. You know, if you maintain the facility in a good operating order, you're going to attract the investors. It's not going to be open-ended because the language says enough, you know, the 2 years to allow a new owner to be able to operate. Members, we passed the renewable energy bill this year. Remember that? You know, a year ago, for us to think about, you know, market opportunities based on RES wasn't within, barely on our horizon. Okay, we've got all sorts of emerging public policy convergence of public policy concerns in regards to the environment that is translating into some great creative new energy thoughts. All I'm saying is this plant could be a place in which we can translate that into realities into creating new energy vehicles or some other related industries. We can't do that, members, if we wind up cannibalizing and selling off that valuable power plant, that energy source. So I don't think it's inconsistent with what the city is doing. I think it's very consistent, and members, I would ask for your support.
Representative Acker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think before we pull the plug and bury these jobs, we ought to take every possible step that we can think of. And to Representative Mariani, I actually believe you have worked towards a compromise, towards some common ground. I heard the same thing 5 years, 3 years, 4 years. And nowhere in this bill, by the way, everybody keeps calling it the moratorium. There's no moratorium. It simply says maintain it in a saleable condition, which, quite frankly, is in Ford's best interest as well. Right. And if you look at the schedule that was distributed by the city, it actually goes hand in glove, timing-wise, within a couple of months, frankly, of what the city's timeline is. So it seems to me that you lift all ships, you give every opportunity to try CPR yet on these terrific jobs before we bury them. And I commend you for working with everybody and finding common ground that hopefully will give every opportunity to save these jobs. If it doesn't, the planning process is going on a parallel track, and we wish the city and we wish all the folks that are working there the very, very best. And anything that we can do to help, I think we ought to do.
Very well put, Representative Atkins. Representative Welkin.
Thank you, Chairman Rukavina, and to Representative Mariani. I have three questions. First of all, it says in here that if it discontinues operation in order to allow the state of Minnesota to be a part of this entity, I guess, that would seek new owners and operators, can you tell me who is the state of Minnesota in this? Who's representing us? Is there a commission? Is there a board? It seems very vague to me. And so, could you answer that question first?
Representative Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Welty, we're the state of Minnesota, and we've got agents that work on economic development. It also says interested and other interested public and private bodies. We heard from a number of them today, and in fact, they've got a process in place. And that's also kind of the beauty of this, is that we're not operating in a vacuum where there isn't an expressed interest on the part of local government. It's there. I would hope that our action on this shows an expressed interest on the part of the state. We've got agents in state government that are our agents in terms of economic development. But right now, members, specifically, we're talking about the task force put forth by the city of St. Paul.
Thank you, Chairman Rukavina. And to Representative Mariani, I guess I would be more comfortable if there was more specificity to this reference to the state of Minnesota. I know I served on government operations in the past 2 years, and usually when we put together some sort of task force or somebody was appointed, we had specific people listed. The second question is, how does it work if a business is in bankruptcy? So it references that in line 1.14, and maybe you could clear that out for me. But if in the future somebody takes this over and then they go into bankruptcy and this legislation is passed, then bankruptcy proceedings, usually you have to liquidate your assets, and this would be one of them. So the state of Minnesota would essentially prohibit anybody from liquidating their assets for 2 years in bankruptcy proceedings. I don't know how this is going to work, so can you provide me with any insight into that?
Representative Welty, maybe I can help with that.
Thank you, Chairman.
In the use of this legislation up north, when it came to taconite plants, one was an LLC and the other one declared bankruptcy, the court
bankruptcy court, so East used some of the assets to keep them in the operating condition.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Rukavina. And then finally, to Representative Mariani, the language is vague when I read it, like on 1.11, when you're talking about must maintain it for operation. Or actually on line 1.10 when it talks about saleable operating condition. Is it your intent that it would be specifically for vehicle manufacturing, or could this bill be used and could this plant be held over for 2 years? And let's say we, because of the renewable energy legislation that we passed, we could end up recruiting somebody to manufacture renewable energy products, and those, and this legislation then could apply to those specific entities.
Representative Mariani.
Chair, we sent Wealthy more the latter to be able to have those broad options available and perhaps minimal retooling of the equipment on site, be able to do alternative products.
Thank you.
Representative Hawk.
Normally, and I don't think this is a moratorium, but normally wouldn't you in a moratorium put a moratorium on for a year and extend it for a year and have trouble keeping it from being a taking after that amount of time?
Is that a question to our in-house attorney or to our...
Do I have to pay you for that after, Representative?
Do you want to answer that one?
I can take a whack at it. Maybe it was with Ms. Novak's help. I think it depends on how you define it, but the fact is that we haven't defined it as moratorium generally would say that you can't sell it.
Yeah.
As opposed to just saying that you have to maintain it in a certain condition. I just wanted to make sure that we were clear that this isn't preventing the sale. In fact, it's promoting the sale. And so it's far from a taking. I think it's in certainly in Ford's best interest, in everybody's best interest, that it be maintained. And hopefully a buyer. In fact, I dispute a little bit the argument that was made about that the market for this sort of thing isn't there. I know that there was a plant that was just, I think it was at Honda or Toyota, just cited a plant down south. We got an educated workforce here. We got a plant. What better place to go than Minnesota? In fact, right here.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Welty reminded me of the state of Minnesota. It does have a big part of this, and it goes along right with what Representative Atkins says. We did offer them the largest job skills partnership grant to teach Ford manufacturer employees lean manufacturing, as well as our management staff. So that's an offer that certainly could be given to another automobile manufacturer if they chose to come here.
Okay, Representative, no further questions, and Representative Moll removes his motion. That House File E26 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Appreciate it.
House File
16657.
Actually, I think I'm going to move mine, Phil, up, because Representative Simon, if you don't mind. I have House File 226, and I have people that came from outside of town. So, Representative Proffy, would you take over? And
if you don't believe in democracy here, you can read this.
Representative Rukavina, if you House File 226, is that the one that's...
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move that. House File 226 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus higher education and workforce development.
Thank you. You may go ahead.
Members, what this bill would do would be to replenish the 21st Century Minerals Fund with the money that was taken plus the interest back in the 2003 session, I believe. when the governor unallotted $50 million or $49 million from the 21st Century Minerals Fund. The 21st Century Minerals Fund was a fund that was established for minerals economic development on the Iron Range, and it was placed over in that fund over a period of about, I think, three legislative sessions, starting with Representative Solberg, who got some initial money back in the 1996 or 7 session, and then through the Ventura administration years. Members, I have with me Mr. Frank Angaro from the non-ferrous, I guess I'll let him describe his group, and Mr. Larry Letnin, who's with Mesaba Nugget. But for your information, some of this money, the money in the 21st Century Fund has gone out before the unallotment happened. Mr. Letnin's project has been a benefactor, along with a small contribution to non-ferrous mining of Fraconia Minerals. And also last year, Representative Solberg did get an $11.5 million appropriation, which some of the money went to one of Mr. Angaro's members. So with that, members, I'll just turn it over to Mr. Angaro and Mr. Letnin.
Go ahead, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Frank Angaro. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Exploration Association Industrial Trade Group that represents environmentally responsible development of Minnesota's non-ferrous, non-iron mining interests in the state of Minnesota. And here today also on behalf of Fraconia Minerals, one of our members, which has an advanced stage exploration project that plans to develop two copper, nickel, platinum group metal deposits in St. Louis and Lake County. We're here today on behalf of the industry to support Representative Rukavina's bill to restore funding to the 21st Century Minerals Fund. First, real quick, in addition to the long history of iron ore being processed and the benefit to the state of Minnesota in northeastern Minnesota, we have a huge untapped resource of base and precious metals along the Iron Range belt of the current existing industry just south and just east for the most part of the White Lakes and Babbitt area. It's approximately 4 billion tons of undeveloped base and precious metal mineral deposits, the largest undeveloped deposit of copper in the nation, a metal which we are some 80% dependent on foreign imports, the only viable nickel deposit in the nation, nickel to make stainless steel, another important national security resources, nickel. We're 100% dependent on foreign resources. A vast amount of platinum and palladium materials needed to make things such as catalytic converters to take out emissions from our gasoline combustion engines. Another product that we are 50 to 70% dependent on imports. So it's also an issue of national security from the standpoint of development opportunities for these deposits. Currently, there are two copper, nickel, platinum group metal projects in the pre-development stage in Minnesota. Minnesota has never operated any base or precious metal mines to date in history. Polymath Mining is one of the companies. They are currently in the environmental review and permitting process, and Fraconia Minerals, which expects to start that rigorous process in approximately a year. There are certainly other groups from Kennecott Exploration to Tecuminco, Duluth Metals, Encampment, and others that have mineral leases on state and federal and private land and are looking at other metallic deposits as well as gold and even diamonds throughout the region and other parts of the state. Madam Chair, members of the committees, in order to foster development of our mineral resources to the benefit of both the local communities, the state, and the nation. Minnesota needs to continue to foster a climate that invites investment in mining in Minnesota, and we believe that the 21st Century Mineral Fund is an essential part of that process. The best example of the projects ready to go is Franconia Minerals. Thanks to some remaining funds in the mineral fund that Representative Rook Davina alluded to, along with funds allocated by the IRRRB and an appropriation last legislative session, Franconia Minerals has negotiated a $2.5 million line of credit from both DEED and the IRRRB for technical work on its Birch Lake project. Though they have not actually drawn on that line of credit, it exists in commercial terms requiring a 3-to-1 match by Franconia. That line of credit has been viewed extremely favorably in the investment community, specifically in Toronto and in New York, but also here in Minnesota. The investment community has looked at this as a vote of confidence by the legislature and the state of Minnesota generally on being supportive of environmentally responsible development of the state of Minnesota's mineral resources. Not all the companies might be interested in looking for this type of financial support. For example, PolyMet has at this stage chosen not to look to the public for any funds for its project. Nonetheless, the image of the state support on behalf of the entire Exploration Association, we believe, is invaluable. I think it's also important to keep in mind that there are a number of things at stake here. It's a perishable product in the standpoint that the technology exists to mine it. The global demand is there. Our consumption is up. The metals market prices are near historic highs. And the overall environment and appetite for investment in base and precious metal mining exists today. If we miss this opportunity in this window, I'm not sure that that will exist for generations to come. Obviously, the jobs that these companies will create are significant to a region that is long important on the need for replacing some of the existing and lost taconite industry jobs. In the case of PolyMet and Franconia, about 400 permanent jobs for PolyMet, about 200 at both the each at the Birch Lake and Maturi projects for Franconia, for about 800 total permanent jobs for at least 20 years, which is the life of the current permit request for the PolyMet project. Also, the revenues that will be generated, not just to local governments, but significant revenue to the state of Minnesota in occupation tax, and always important to keep in mind royalties. In the case of Franconia's Birch Lake project, on a significant amount of state mineral owned minerals, and those royalty funds dollars will flow into the school trust fund, which goes to help hold down school costs in K-12 education across the entire state of Minnesota. Obviously, Minnesota has had a long history of mineral activity, and it's been a cyclical industry. We believe restoring the 21st Century Mineral Fund and the use of that fund to assist especially these smaller entrepreneurial companies in their efforts to properly develop Minnesota's vast mineral potential will raise the public and investment community's perception of Minnesota as a place to invest in mining, and we will see these companies move from project to fruition and provide the jobs, revenue that are much needed, not just in northeastern Minnesota, but the state as a whole. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. We'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ungaro. And then Mr. Lettinen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk. My name is Larry Lettinen. I'm the founder of Mesabi Nugget, president of Ferrometrics Incorporated, and a member of the board of Mesabi Nugget. Mesabi Nugget was founded in 2001. It's a success story, I think, for the 21st Century Mineral Fund. I founded that company in 2001 and received initial seed capital from the 21st Century Mineral Fund. And with that, I was able to attract capital from an investment from partners in Japan, Kobe Steel, Steel Dynamics from Indiana, and Cleveland Cliffs from Cleveland, Ohio, as well as additional funding from the federal level. $33 million was raised in the initial efforts of Sabi Nabi Nut, and it's culminated in an investment decision by one of my partners, Steel Dynamics, along with Kobe Steel, to invest about $235 million into the initial stages of the project. We've received $16 million in 21st Century Mineral Fund dollars to this point. Of the $235 million to go into the Mesabi Nugget investment over the next 2 years, $20 million will be coming from the 21st Century Fund. So it's been an important part of the financial package for that project. There's another $30 million that's being invested by one of our suppliers, Cleveland Cliffs, at Silver Bay, on top of the $235 million. So $265 million is being invested in phase one of our project. It promises to be an even better investment going forward. My partners have plans to invest somewhere between $700 and $800 million into that site, pending success on the first phase of this project and future permitting work. But the $36 million that came from the fund, or partially came from the fund so far and dedicated to come forward in this first phase, has been critical for the investment to date by Steel Dynamics and Cleveland Cliffs and Kobe Steel. The replenishment of this fund is important for my partners going forward as they're looking for continuing investment beyond this first phase. I know that the presence of this fund was important in attracting them to invest in Minnesota originally. When I brought these member companies to Minnesota a few years ago, they were looking at alternative sites around the globe. And the existence of this fund is the primary reason why Kobe Steel, who owns the technology, came to Minnesota in the first place. So I would respectfully request that the committee consider replenishing this fund, as it has turned out to be a very important part of our investment program at Mesabi Nugget.
Thank you. Yes. Mr. Spencer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Lettinen, how much of an equity position do you think the state should take in your venture, percentage-wise?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the state isn't going to be in the projection going forward. The state won't be an equity participant in this project. All of that money is debt financing and to be repaid to the 21st Century Fund in one form or another. So there isn't any equity investment of that that fund going into our project. It's all debt financing.
That's the end of the answer.
So it's a loan then?
That's right.
Mr. Dario, how much is presently in the 21st Century Mineral Fund?
Mr. Chair, I think.
$20
million? Madam Chair, I think I can answer that. I think there is $11 million in the 21st Century Mineral Fund that was put in last year, Representative Gunther, that's dedicated to Minnesota Steel Industries in law over at the potential steel mill. But these two folks represent different entities that might use that. I think, you know, right now, Mr. Lettinen, we put in $8 million of 21st Century Mineral Fund matched by the IRRRB for the pilot plant, and then I believe another $10 million each was committed. So both by IRRRB and by the 21st Century Fund. That was from Sovereign Nuggets, so that would have been $18 million of state money and $18 million of IRRRB money. And for Fraconia, there was $750,000 left in that fund, Representative Gunther, and when Representative Solberg got the $11.5 million last year, we used that $750,000 that was left in the $0.5 million of the $11.5 million for Fraconia for this drilling project, which was matched
dollar for dollar by the IRRB, and which should lever about $7.5 million, I think.
One more question.
Members of the committee, a 3-to-1 match requirement. Okay, so I'm not quite.
All right, Representative Gunther.
Representative Rocavino, your math is a little quicker than I can keep track of. With the money that that the governor took, as you so aptly put, and I agree with that, by the way, how much more money have we spent than we originally had? And how much with what you're asking for?
Let me try to see if I can get the figures right. We have a $60 million fund, and the interest that was supposed to accrue to it, and some interest did accrue. The IRRB matched the initial $60 million with $20 million. And we spent the state's share, we spent $18 million, or committed $18 million to Mesaba Nugget, and $1.25 million to Fraconia, and I believe that is all there is, and then there's that $11 million sitting out there, so it would be $19.25 million plus the $11 million. $30 million is either committed or has been used of the original 60, and the interest, I think, would have been around, I'm not sure, Mr. Berg maybe can help me out, but the dollar amount in here was including the interest that would have built up just from when they took the unallotment.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Rocavini, you know, there's nothing I'd rather see in the whole world than greater Minnesota economic development and growth. And I don't care how much money it is. Will you do one thing? Would you tell me, if you get this money by some chance, will you promise never to bring up the fact that I was there when they took the money?
Representative Gunther, I know, Madam Chair, and I guess I can publicly say that on the record that I would promise that.
Okay.
Especially if you voted for it in the omnibus bill. But, you know, Representative Gunther, I have to say I never did blame you, and a lot of us never blamed you because we knew you had your marching orders. And unfortunately, Representative Gunther, your marching orders for the whole Economic Development Finance Committee were extremely cruel, I thought. And you had to do a lot of things I know that you didn't want to do, and you tried to help out and tap the Workforce Development Fund and did everything you could to try to make things work, and I commend you for that. But, you know, I do have to say, members, that if Mr. Lettman's project does go, which is about $230 million of investment or a little more, and if they actually then build their little taconite plant that they want to utilize their minerals there that they were negotiating, it's a $600-700 million investment, and then they start mining, on school trusts, I think, and university land. One of the two. Members, the potential for royalties to both permanent school fund and the permanent university fund are huge with this project, and the Polymeth and Fraconi both also are on a lot of state and university land. So it would be a wise investment, I believe.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina. No further questions on this bill? Then we will thank you, the witnesses, and we will go on to your next bill, which is House File 1199. Did you want?
I was willing to let Representative Simon not. He had to take over. My 1199 bill, he's lobbyist.
Thank you. Then Representative Simon is coming forward with House File 657.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 690.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Hello, Representative Simon. Welcome to the committee. You may go ahead and start addressing House File 657.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I know you have a lot to cover tonight, so we'll try to make it brief. This is the deed housekeeping bill. But before I turn it over to the able housekeepers, I have a few words to say, and I'm going to do something a little bit unorthodox, which is actually flag for you what I think is the most controversial part of the bill. We might as well talk about it. And the other thing is that I know that I may not get a chance to talk because these two and some others will really kind of walk you through the bill and really know the details better than I do. But the one portion of this housekeeping bill, and that's what it truly is for the most part, that I would imagine will be somewhat controversial, is Section 5 of the bill, Might as well just get that out there. And Section 5 would change the current practice for a pot of redevelopment money from going just to Greater Minnesota to having it equitably distributed throughout the state, as it once was, by the way. It was only in recent years that it was turned into a program that went to all areas of the state to one that just went to Greater Minnesota, and we can have that discussion. I want to flag it for you. Somewhat unorthodox, but I think it's the fair thing to do. And for what it's worth, I mean, one of the reasons I'm motivated to do it is because I know in my district, we really have benefited from monies like this. In St. Louis Park, a great renewal project that has really helped breathe some life into an area of town that really needed it. And I think as a result of that and similar programs, speaking for St. Louis Park, I think we've been able to do what other first-ring suburbs haven't been able to do, and others that have not fared as well perhaps didn't have the opportunity that we did. So that other communities like ours can have that same opportunity. That's why I support that provision of the bill, but I'm sure we'll get to that, and it'll be an interesting discussion. So let me turn it over to the folks who can walk you through section by section of the bill and tell you what's in it.
Welcome to the committee. Who's doing by?
Thank what? You.
Just identify yourself for the record.
Sorry. Hear me. I have the first four sections of the bill. My name is Meredith Hudoybach, and I'm the director of the Brownfields and Community Assistance Unit at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And I'll go through the sections quickly and tell you what they do. The first section of the bill deals with our contamination cleanup grant program. We have three sources of money in this program. One of them is available until spent, and the other two sources of funds are available for 4 years. And they're available for 4 years at the beginning of the biennium. This grant program we run cycles every 6 months. So 4 years worth of money really by the last cycle of the second year of the biennium really becomes 2 years that money is available. And that becomes important for us because with contamination cleanup grant projects, they usually take a little bit longer to get moving than other economic development projects because of the fact that there's contamination on the site. A lot of the times the projects aren't quite as cooked and the financing might not quite be in place from the other sources until they figure out whether or not they're going to get grant funds. So we find that they take a little bit longer, and we certainly don't want to lose any of the money to this doubly oversubscribed program. So we would like to make all of our funds available until spent. And because of the fact that we run grant cycles every 6 months, we fill up a lot of grants for administering on our plate, so it certainly is not our intent to have anyone sit on that money and move those projects along as quickly as possible. So we would certainly be prudent in having that language available until spent, making sure that those dollars are moving as quickly as possible. Sections 2 and 3 of the bill also are another housekeeping provision for our contamination cleanup grant program. We have a valuation piece in our current statute, and it's under our qualifying criteria section. It basically says that in order to be eligible for our grant funds, you have to have a low land value and a very high cleanup cost. We think that's a very prudent thing to look at. However, we think it's misplaced in our statute, and we would like to take it out of the qualifying criteria and move it to our priority section, where we would look at that criteria in assessing the priorities of who we're going to give grant funds to. That would line that requirement up with our other funding partners, such as the Met Council and Hennepin County and Ramsey County, who also look at such a evaluation provision, but it's not something that is necessary for projects to qualify for funding, but it's something that they look at in deciding whether or not they need grant funds. So we'd like to just move that provision into a more appropriate section. Section 4 and 5, I'll spend a little bit more time on because, as Representative Simon said, it might be one of the more controversial parts of our housekeeping bill, and it has to do with our redevelopment grant program. This program was created back in 1998. It was originally a statewide program. To date, we've awarded close to $35 million through the program. We've increased the tax base by about $12.2 million. Created about 8,000 jobs, and with that $35 million have leveraged over $811 million in private investment. It's been a very popular program. It's always doubly oversubscribed, and originally it was a statewide program. During the Ventura administration, the program went through some transitions. It was made into a Greater Minnesota-only program with the intent that the Met Council would be doing a redevelopment program for the metro area. That never occurred, and the metro area ended up without any redevelopment resources. currently our statute says that we are only to give money to metro projects if we don't have enough money, or projects from Greater Minnesota that come in, and that's not the case. So essentially we are still at a Greater Minnesota only program. What we would like to do, as I said, is bring the program back to a statewide jurisdiction. As a statewide agency, we see that there are redevelopment needs that are all over the state, and we would like to be able to address some of the needs everywhere. What our proposal is, as the original statute was created, is that we would guarantee 25% of the funds to go to Greater Minnesota, and the rest of the funds would be available to Greater Minnesota and the Metro on a competitive basis. I had a handout sent out to you, and what that handout shows is what we were able to do with the program under the original statute. And the first piece of that handout is a map. And you can see that under that guarantee of 25% funds and the rest being competitive throughout the state, we were able to fund projects throughout all of Minnesota. The pie charts, the first ones, will show you that the applications that came in from the various areas of the state, and it's divided by Greater Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the suburban areas. The applications were funded at basically the same rate that they came in. So that shows that under that scenario, we were able to address all the needs at the dollar amounts where they came in. So we think that this 25% guarantee works really well for the entire state. I've worked on redevelopment projects, well, since this program was created in 1998, and I have never been able to come across any other funding source that helps with the redevelopment needs that this program can address. And so it really leaves a hole for the metro area in particular without having this funding source available to them. We want to be able to address the funding needs across all of Minnesota. We want to be able to not only continue to do the projects in the city of Virginia, where we did a Horace Mann project. It was an old school that we gave $200,000 to and helped redevelop it into affordable housing. We also want to continue to do the projects in Owatonna that we did, that was a Northgate project where we gave $176,000 to convert an old dilapidated office into some housing. But we also want to be able to, again, look at some of the projects that we've done along the Phelan Corridor, where we helped address some of those old dilapidated buildings and allow for the corridor to come through, and also the Great Lakes Center that we did, or the Sears Building, where we assisted in some of the redevelopment projects or costs in that project as well. So our intent is to, of course, make sure that our funds are being equitably distributed to all parts of Minnesota, but we want to be able to look at all the redevelopment needs that are not only in Greater Minnesota, but also in the metro area as well.
Okay, thank you. Sir?
Mr. Chair, my name is John Sherman. I'm with the Community Partners Section of Rehabilitation Services, which means that, but I've always wanted to be with the State Department. The Section 6 designates DEED as the official state's office of protocol for foreign visitors coming to particularly meet the governor and the lieutenant governor. Right now we do not have one. We actually do have a substantial number of visitors who come in, and the function is handled by the Minnesota Trade Office. This would officially designate that protocol function to the Trade Office. That would be Section 6. Section 7, 8, 9, and 10 all are concerned with the extended employment program, which you have regularly taken testimony on in terms of what the program does in providing supports to individuals with very serious disabilities. These sections have been supported by MACRO and were developed essentially. Well, the original language in statute is now over two decades old, and we, if you will, the ability to provide employment for individuals with disabilities has broadened in those two decades, and we are frankly clearing up some issues. Section 7 changes the adds language to a supported employment definition that's in statute. It needs to work with Section 10 jointly because of instructions from the revisor's office that we're not allowed to put policy in a definition section. So Section 10 implements, Section 7 defines and widens the scope of supported employment. Section 10 allows us to, in fact, individually go in and look at sites on community rehabilitation programs. Section 8 adds a new category to the extended employment program called the Affirmative Business Enterprise. It was developed following the work of Occupational Development Center in Thief River Falls and their customs products industry, in which they provide the shipping carts for Polaris and many other industries. It's a new model of employment that enhances wages, enhances benefits, and frankly had no place in our system. We're proposing language and a place in our funding system for that. Section 9 essentially clears out archaic board language, and the current statute requires a certain minimum number of individuals and a certain composition, and frankly we believe that these organizations are grown up and frankly do very well on their own without with the state interfering in their board membership. Section 10, as I said, implements Section 9 in a way that allows us to use the definitional change. Section 11 does not concern extended employment. It repeals a report for a function in purchasing and procurement that we no longer do and have not done for a while. That function is handled at this point by the Department of Administration. So we're, in effect, asking you to repeal a section that allows us to stop sending you a report that tells you nothing.
Okay. Questions? Representative Simon.
Chair, I'm sorry, I neglected to mention at the beginning, I do have an author's amendment.
Okay. Do we have the author's amendment here? I guess we do. Is this it here? Representative Simon, is it
I'd like to offer the A3 amendment, Mr. Chair.
The A3, okay. Representative Mahoney moves the 80657 A3 amendment, titled Section 7, Nonprofit Corporate Loans. Go ahead. Representative Simon, do you want to explain it?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, to help explain it and to tell the committee really what it does is Dave Chapman from the Minneapolis Consortium of Community Developers.
Chapman, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee members, what we're looking to do is just change a bit of language in the MGLOD to allow the interest rate on this loan fund to go from a fixed cap of 10% to a floating at prime plus 4, and then also to allow the member the participant organizations to charge an origination fee of up to 1% on loans that have been made. I just want to say that the Minneapolis Consortium is one of the partners and one of the participants in the Urban Initiative Program, along with African Development Center, the American Indian Economic Development Fund, Central Minnesota Development Company, Metropolitan Economic Development Association, the Milestone Growth Fund, Neighbor Development Center, Riverview Economic Development Association, SPARC, and Women Venture. The reasons for the changes are that the program is to provide access to capital, and it's a requirement that the businesses or aspiring entrepreneurs are not able to obtain the financing through traditional financing sources. At least they can't obtain all the financing. And in some cases, they can't obtain any of the financing through those sources. So what we want to do is we want to make sure that that the loan interest rate is not attractive to borrowers that can obtain traditional financing. So if we set a loan rate at 4 plus prime, that's pretty much going to take out the organizations that are viable and that could get traditional financing, so that they won't be coming to us because our rate is better than the bank rate. And then as far as the origination fee goes, it's really to help offset program costs. Currently, the participant organizations are allowed to keep the interest that is generated on the loan from the loan repayments while returning the principal portion to the state. there's a formula for that whereby we can keep the interest up to the amount of our program costs. And I don't know of, at least our organization and the other ones that I know of, have never met that threshold where we've had to remit part of the interest back. So we're just looking to help us offset some of the costs because we expend more on this than we receive back in the interest.
Okay, you've heard the explanation. Any questions? If not, then Representative Mahoney moves the 8th Amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Mahoney, had the other 2 years?
Yes, they are, and I'd like to offer the A2 Amendment.
Representative Mahoney moves the A2 Amendment. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the A2 Amendment reads on line 1.4, redevelopment costs related to expansion of a bioscience business in Minnesota. And I've been approached by many rural members talking about what's going on in their particular towns and cities. I don't see why we shouldn't allow, if there's an opportunity for it, just allow it, let Deed make the decision whether it's a good project or not and whether it meets their threshold of priorities. Has no, not trying to broker any deal or give anyone a leg up. It just says that's just going to be considered.
Questions on the amendment? If not, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Mahoney, the...
At this time, I don't think I'll offer the other amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Questions, then, of the author or the bill itself? Representative Haas, did you have a question?
No, I was not being distracted.
Okay. That's okay.
Myself.
If not, no further questions, then Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House Bill 657, as amended, be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus higher education, finance, and workforce development bill. Thank you, Representative Simon and members. Okay, the next bill up, Representative Clark, do you want to move some of your bills around maybe? So I noticed you've got testifiers in the audience, a number of them on. Do you want to take 1485 first or 1355?
Oh, maybe I should take 1485. This is special people.
Okay, and maybe your testifiers could keep their comments too short. Can we get out of here? Bye. Representative Clark moves House Bill 1485. He recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education and Workforce Development Finance Bill. Representative Clark. House Bill 1485.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House
Bill. Yes, you already did.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. Well, there are a number of people here who are involved with the global market, which is what this bill is basically trying to do. We're trying to help the global market, which is flush with minority businesses. It's a wonderful place. If any of you haven't been there, I want to invite you to come and visit. It's the old Sears building in Minneapolis. And it's a very exciting place to be. Incredibly creative businesses there. And many of them are struggling a bit, although they've also been very successful. And what this bill does is it does appropriate $4.5 million to make sure that we retain those businesses at the global marketplace using the Urban Challenge Grant Program for loans and microloans and technical assistance and training, and also for working with them on another part of some of the work with the Neighborhood Development Center. And we're going to ask Mr. Mike Tamale to talk a little bit about this bill. Mr. Chairman, we'll have a couple of people testify, and then I did want to ask all the people who are here from the global marketplace if they might stand to be recognized and see some of the...
Thank you very much for coming this evening.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mr. Tamale.
Thank you, Chairman Rukavina and Representative Clark. I was going to introduce all of them by name and ask them to each come up and make a speech, but maybe I shouldn't do that. My name is Mike Tamale. I'm the Executive Director of the Neighborhood Development Center. We're one of four nonprofit organizations that developed this project and now run it. I would like to ask John Flora if he would stand up. He's with the Latino Economic Development Center. That's another one of the nonprofits that has built this project with us. We've also built the Mercado Central at Lake in Bloomington and other projects like that. We opened the project to the public in May. We were at half occupancy. We were rushed by the fact that the Sears building had been on a very fast time frame, and Alina had moved in, started moving in with some of their 1,800 employees. At that point, by last May, there was already about 800 people in the building, and there was many of the 200-plus apartments and 100-plus condos were being occupied. We're now at 90% occupancy, which is ahead of schedule. We're also seeing 3,500 customers a day, which is more than projected. We had projected 2,500 customers a day. Of these customers, we have done customer intercept surveys of almost 300 with Bethel College marketing class. 96% of those surveyed said they loved the market and they were coming back. So all that's very positive. However, many of the businesses, in fact, probably most of the businesses in most months we've been open, have really struggled to break even. Part of the problem, the main problem, is that we're in a ramp-up situation, and it's taking us probably a little bit longer to ramp up than anticipated. One of the realities is that we're discovering that of the 3,500 people a day who come in, many are wanderers as much as they're shoppers, and we're trying to convert that. We have a ramp-up strategy that involves developing our grocery offerings in there, having a lot more both ethnic and Minnesota-grown groceries offered in there, and having more customer conveniences for customers so that we can drive more weekly customers both from the neighborhood, from the Alliance employee base, and from the region. Today we do have 50 businesses open. 90% of those are owned by persons of color, and about half of them are startups, and another 40% are what we call second step businesses. So this is truly a business incubator. Most of these folks came through our training programs that we offer, 16-week class. They have over 250 jobs created in there at this point in time. At minimum, we're anticipating $1.5 million of taxes paid on an annual basis. The Star Tribune has reported a 25% reduction in crime around the global market, but we are in a very tough neighborhood. The Phillips neighborhood is got a pretty negative reputation and a fairly high level of crime, and it is quite a deterrent to customers from the region coming in. And for that matter, a lot of the folks that work at Alina seem to evacuate pretty quick at about 4 o'clock when day is done for them, and we're having to really reach out to them to try to get them in to shop. We have created a fantastic gathering place for the community, and every tenant that you see in there is truly a role model for folks in their communities. The rents have been high. They're over $32 a square foot plus utilities, which is on the high side. The reason is that the project was an extremely expensive project, being that we're in a large multi-use building and a historic rehab building. We paid over $18 million to build the project. We also did come to the through the bonding process 2 years ago and had an approval on the House side and the Senate side that did not survive the conference committee, unfortunately, but that probably would have relieved the need to be here today if that had survived that process. I would like to ask four of our tenants to speak briefly, the first one being Michael Wright from Golden Time Coffee Shop. Michael.
Welcome to the committee, Michael.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Approximately 7 years ago, I had an opportunity to open a coffee shop in St. Paul in a very notorious area of the Selby Dale area there. And It was a place that I wanted to go. But we turned that area around in approximately 3 years to where it is now, where if one wanted to buy a home 7 years ago in that area, you could get a home there for about $60,000 or so, maybe a little less. Nowadays, as most of you know, the homes in that area are going anywhere for high twos, threes, and even four, which is right next door to the building that I now occupy, which was a very notorious store in its time. So it's going to take time for us to get there, and we'd really like your consideration in allowing us to see our vision and what we would like to do as self-reliant people, pulling our bootstraps up and making things viable in the Lake and Chicago area. Once again, I'll reiterate what Mike said, it's a very tough community, but I think we can bring them along as we did with the Selby area. I also started what was called the Selby Avenue Jazz Fest, which is coming up this year, be our sixth year doing the Selby Avenue Jazz Fest, something that we also would like to do in the Chicago Lake area. But I'll make it real brief here. What we'd like to do is bring the whole community up and bring them along. But we need your consideration and help to sustain ourselves, as Mike said, as we ramp up and alleviate some of the costs associated with this whole project. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Why don't just one of you jump in and identify yourself?
I'm Lori Callister. I own Farm in the Market at the Global Market. I'm from West Concord, Minnesota, and I'm the rural connection to this group. I'm a farmer. We raise chickens and turkeys and have laying hens, and we've sold at the St. Paul Farmers Market since the year 2000. And when this opportunity came along to join the Midtown Global Market, we jumped in both feet and made the leap from direct marketing at a farmer's market to full-time retail marketing in a 7-day-a-week situation. We carry all local products in our store, meat, dairy, cheese, jams, jellies, honeys, anything that's produced in Minnesota or Wisconsin, western Wisconsin, by small family farms, small processors and producers, we carry it. I know we're connected to about 40 families in the rural areas, and we've been important for every one of them, bringing a connection to them that they didn't have before. Also, it's really heartwarming to have the connection to the people in the neighborhood near the Global Market. They love to have a farmer to talk to and somebody that actually produced the food that they're eating. It's just every day we hear how grateful they are that the Global Market opened and is helping to turn their neighborhoods around, because most of the people there did not like the situation that the neighborhood was in either, and they're just really rooting for us and very supportive. And it's going to take a little while for us to get up to speed so we can be full-time, support ourselves and turn a profit. But we'll get there. It's just going to take a little while. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Manny Gonzalez, and I own Manny's Tortas. These are gourmet Mexican sandwiches. I've been living in Minnesota for 25 years, and I have three locations. And my third location, it was opened 7 years ago in the Mercado Central, Lake and Bloomington. My second location is in Lake and 27. And my third location is in Lake and Chicago. I love Lake Street. I have a great experience with the Mercado Central. At first, I didn't want to go to that area because it was very bad area. And what the Mercado Central did, it changed the dynamic of that area. And I think that was fabulous. We give jobs to a lot of people in that area. And for me, to go to the Global Market, it will be something that we can change the same thing in that area. And I think it's a fabulous place. Like in the brochures that you guys have, it says many cases, one place. I think the dynamic of that place is a lot of energy from around the world. So we really want to make that place a tourist destination. So we really like your support this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gonzalez. Go ahead, sir.
Good evening, Chairman. My name is Jamal Hashi, and I'm one of the Global Market entrepreneurs as well.
This will be my second location as well, and I have a restaurant right now that's located in downtown Minneapolis. And basically, like everyone here said, you know, we're here actually tonight fleeing and saying that we need your help, you know, in surviving. And this is a great place, and many of you guys, if you haven't been there, it's like Manny was saying, you know, many tastes, one place. It's actually like growing around the world without actually going around the world, you know. And there's so many languages that are spoken in that place. It's amazing. And, you know, 5 continents of, you know, different people, and it's an amazing place. And, you know, I want to see this place go to places, and I think it's a landmark for Minnesota, hopefully, in the near future. And I would love to see this place fly. So, you know, thanks for hearing us out.
Okay. Thank you all for your testimony. We really appreciate it. Are there any questions for the witnesses or Mr. Tamale or Representative Clark? Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Clark.
You can take all the time you want.
I've shopped at the Global Market. It's one of the more fun places to go. They have food from everywhere, and it's fantastic. If you are locked up in a stuffy apartment, waiting for that legislative session to begin on Monday, and you've got nothing to do over the weekend, go visit. The parking is cheap, real cheap. The entertainment's great. It's a really fun, interesting place. I grocery shop there sometimes. It's just got its cool stuff, and it's a lot of fun. Just us.
I was really started to pay attention when you said if you are locked up.
Well, you know what I mean.
Okay. Well, any further questions? Then thank you all for your testimony, and Representative Clark, we'll move on to your next bill. I think we'll take House File 1355.
That's right.
And Representative Clark would move that House File 1355 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus higher education workforce development bill. Go ahead, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is a bill that puts an appropriation into Women Ventures, a wonderful organization for economic development. And Women Venture isn't the governor's budget. What we're offering here tonight is a little bit more than the governor had proposed because there's an expansion in the wings here. And I want to ask Mr. Nate Wells to talk a little bit about that.
You know, Representative Clark, I have to say, you are really good. You know, it must be your demeanor or whatever, because I always said you were one of my angels. But you got money hidden all over the place. And there is, Women Ventures is in the base, but you're just going to increase it.
Right.
Or try to. No, it's not because of my demeanor that anybody's anything nice for me. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much. My name is Tanae Wells, and I'm the president of Women Venture. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and, of course, Representative Clark and Ruth Covina and Gunther and Ruth and Pope for authoring this bill. As we've indicated, I also have joining me today Amy Brennigan, who's the director of programs, and she's going to tell you a little bit about some of our business clients. Unfortunately, they could not join us because they're working. I want to thank the state of Minnesota for over 20 years of support and for understanding the importance of investing in women and low-income businesses. The demand for our services is increasing, and we would like to increase our support so that we can help more budding entrepreneurs. Specifically, we have an opportunity to be part of the Anoka County Technical College's Entrepreneur Center, which is on Highway 10, and we expect that we will be seeing an additional 500 people in that outer ring suburb and also be able to serve more people in the rural community. Women Venture is in the governor's budget at $300,000 in the base, and we're requesting an expansion to $560,000 to help us expand our services into the outer Anoka area, but also to help take up to help us be able to support the 200% increase that we've seen in the demand for our services in the local area as well. We serve the 17-county metropolitan area, and we have been called upon as far away as Owatonna and Representative Roos area, as well as far north as Fergus Falls. We also have a need to find more creative ways to work with the banking community to help the banks reduce their default rates and to increase our clients' access to capital and to significantly increase our services in the outer ring suburbs and rural areas. All of you know that small business is the backbone of our economy. 70% of all the jobs are created by small businesses. And I'd like to tell you just one of my stories that I like to tell all the time, and then Amy's going to tell you a couple of others. One of our most important clients, or most significant clients, is a woman named Lynn Gordon. Lynn Gordon owns French Meadow Bakery. French Meadow is an organic bakery that's located on 26th and Lindale. When Lynn came to us 20 years ago to help start this bakery, nobody would talk to her. She was a really kind of kooky woman. She made hemp bread, and we were all eating Wonder Bread and not eating organic food and being as healthy as we are now. Lynn had a vision that we would change, and as we've aged, we have changed, and we all know the value of eating organic foods now. Lynn's bakery is located on 26th and Lindale. She has employed over hundreds of people. She pays them a livable wage, and she hires people from that community. What you might not know is that her concept has been, she's working with Host, which is a concession for the airport, and there are people, she has a organic restaurant out in the airport across from F4. There are people that fly through Minneapolis just to be able to stop on their way across the country and get a good organic meal. Lynn will be, and is expanding, is going to make millions of dollars, sells 44,000 loaves of bread a year. She's the exception to the story, but she started out this business baking this bread in rented kitchens in the middle of the night. She'd bag up this warm bread. She'd go home to her kids, and her kids would bag this bread up and take it to the co-ops that existed at that time. But she had a vision, and she worked hard. She invested her own money. She found a way to be able to freeze the bread so she could sell the bread nationally with the support of the technical assistance that she received from Women Venture. Your dollars help us give those businesses that technical assistance that they need so they can grow. Now, Lynn is an exception. Most of our businesses are not million-dollar businesses selling bread all over the world and at the airport. Most of our businesses are like the ones that Amy's going to tell you about.
Okay, welcome to the committee. I just tell you something. 20 years ago, I was grinding my own wheat berries, making homemade bread. Now I'm eating Wonder Bread. What happened to me?
You were one of the exceptional healthy ones, Chairman.
Okay. Amy, welcome to the committee. Identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Amy Brennan. I'm the program director at Women Venture. And as Tanae said, that story is a wonderful story, but it represents one end of the spectrum, and many of our business owners represent the other end of the spectrum. Inside your packets today, you have some profiles of some of our fabulous women who have received funding from us and who have started businesses that help themselves and help their communities. One of the women that's not in your packet but that we'd love to talk about is Linda Lake, who is the owner of a flower shop out on Highway 12, and she bought this flower shop and began her business as a single mother with children. As an alternative, she didn't know how she was going to continue to work. She had opportunities away from where she lived, and she couldn't figure out a way to make a new job work after being laid off. So she pursued her dream, which was starting a business, like so many women that we work with. And she was very resourceful, like so many entrepreneurs. She got space donated by a church member in the back of a bait shop, which as staff sort of shocked us, but it turned out that her opening weekend was the fishing opener and Mother's Day. So many of the clients who came to get their bait also picked up a bouquet of flowers for the mothers in their lives. And this business has turned so successful, and she just came back to us for a second loan for expansion, and we're very pleased for her. She is just one of hundreds of entrepreneurs that we work with every year that show that grit and determination to turn themselves around, turn their lives around, and turn their communities around.
We've come to you for the last 18 years, and we've asked you to make an investment in Women Venture. And we've told you at each one of those times that that investment is an excellent return. For the past 7 years, since I've been the president of Women Venture, I've told you that for every $1 that you invest in this program, we return it to the state in the form of the we return $11 to the state in the form of wages, taxes, and sales taxes. Last year, the University of Minnesota's Carleton School of Management evaluated our results. Dr. Carla Provone interviewed randomly selected Women Venture clients who had received loans for us for the past 10 years. This study is one of the items at the back of the packets that I've given you. But let me tell you what she found. She found that these clients had limited business experiences, that the median income was less than $34,000. They had low credit scores. Many of them had bankruptcies. The businesses were located in empowerment zones, enterprise communities, distressed urban and rural areas. However, most of these businesses agreed that was the Women Venture technical assistance and advice that made them succeed. 10 years later, the results are amazing. 68% of these businesses are still open. 75% of them are profitable. The median income is $78,000. What's the impact of the state of Minnesota? These businesses created 652 jobs with revenues of $20.3 million and sales tax of $1.3 million. These are better odds than any other investment or any stock options that I've ever heard of in the return of these businesses. I'm asking you today, I know you've got a lot of decisions to make and limited funds, but I'm asking you today to make a wise investment by allowing us to be able to serve more people. Our technical assistance resources are needed by all businesses, and the work that we'll be able to do as we expand into the Anoka community is really going to allow us to be able to expand in an area that does not have any technical assistance support for businesses in the community. We've been in the area for 3 years working in partnership with the Anoka County Technical College, and as a result of that, they have built an entrepreneur center on Highway 10, and they want us to come and to service that entrepreneur center. We'll serve over 500 businesses in that area. The guys that have taken a class and want to be a plumber will be able to think about what happens is you get your license, you're a plumber, you go work for 4 years, and then you realize that all you got to do is slap a sign on a van and you can be your own business owner. We're going to expedite that opportunity for them. And what we know about these businesses is these businesses will put their sweat equity and their hard work, and they'll make these businesses work. These owners will use their own savings, their own skills, their tenacity to get started, and all of them will work hard to make their businesses successful. They will pay their bills on time, they will pay their employees a livable wage, and they will repay the state in the taxes from the wages and the sales taxes from those businesses. The state can ensure that the success and the repayment of this investment is provided by supporting the technical assistance that we provide to those businesses to make those businesses successful. As I said, you've got lots of information. I don't want to take up any more of your time. I really hope that you can see that expanding the resources that support Women Venture will allow us to be able to expand more businesses. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. And Representative Clark, any questions? It's a very viable program. Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. I appreciate what you do regardless, but I have to tell you that I appreciate it even more now because Lynn Gordon was my cooking teacher 22 years ago. So now I have a story.
Fabulous. Well, you have to go to a martini bar. She's got an organic martini bar over there.
We're checking that one out, Amber.
I make a motion we adjourn.
Representative Horton.
Where is that organic martini bar?
It's in the airport in the main section.
Good to know. Thank
we're
you.
There.
I just learned about Cosmos the other day, so I'm... Did you have a question, Representative Slocum? Okay.
I was merely laughing.
Okay. Thank you, ladies, very much, and we hope we can do something for you. Money's a little tight. Representative Clark, I'd like to take up my house file now, $11.99, rather than... And then you can come back to wrap it up with your two bills, which
thank
I don't think you have any testimony. Other
no, I don't. And just to thank you for letting the folks who are here.
Representative Rukavina moves House File 1199.
for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a bill that was brought to me by a friend of mine from the steelworkers, and I believe also that the AFL-CIO has some interest in it. And I'm going to let Mr. Brad Leto from the AFL-CIO and Stan Daniels from the steelworkers talk about it. But basically what it does is it gives the legislature really some involvement in working with the governor's office when pay decisions are made for the state of Minnesota. I don't know when the last pay decisions were made, but I do believe that Governor Valente has entered into some and maybe tried to back out of some or at least not support some. So with that, I don't know who wants to start here first. I will say that the Department of Administration does have a little bit of concerns about the bill because they don't know what Section 3 would require of them, and former Representative Rhodes is here maybe to discuss that. So I think, you know, I don't have a fiscal note. We requested one regarding Section 3 would be the place where it would be involved, and I'm more than willing to look at removing that for the time being. I think that the Department of Administration does look at what their contracting out costs and has some of that information, but they were concerned about what the overall request of this bill might do to them. So with that, Madam Chair, if it's okay, I'll turn it over to, I don't know who wants to start, Mr. Daniels.
Sounds good. Mr. Daniels, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stan Daniels. I represent the Steelworkers District 11, which we have about 16,000 members in Minnesota and another 20,000, or not 10,000 retirees, and we have about 850,000 members in the United States. We're the largest industrial union in the United States. And we're here to support this. Right now, the trade policies are set by the federal government, and a lot of times the state legislator doesn't even know what the state does with the policies. The policies are set, and they come to the governor, and he stamps their approval. We're saying that that's just not right, that we might not be able to disagree with the federal policies on trade, but the state of Minnesota and the legislators, and like other states, can set their own policies. They don't have to abide by the federal policies. They have to support them, but they don't have to abide by them. You can set up your own trade policies and set up your own trade legislative committees and talk about trade policies for what's best for the state of Minnesota. And a lot of states are doing this now. I know the state of Pennsylvania, where we have our main office for the steelworkers, the governor there has passed, in I think around 2001, 2002, some very good trade policies for the state of Pennsylvania. We think that the policy that we need is a trade policy that protects Minnesota jobs and businesses. Not unfair trade policies that penalizes businesses in the state of Minnesota and labor organizations that negotiate good wages and good skilled jobs, and then they have to compete with trade policies that give foreign companies and foreign investments unfair advantage. We think that we should support state businesses and state wages and policies, and therefore that's why we support the bill, and I'll let Mr. Ladle more or less explain some parts of the bill. Thank you.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Please just state your name first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Brad Leto. I guess my mind's getting fuzzy. Brad Leto, Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And we certainly support the legislation. And actually, the legislation, and I think probably Section 3 may come up. We actually are working. We have spoken with the Department of Administration and actually the Department of Employment and Economic Development this evening. And we probably will flip the main authority to the Department of Employment and Economic Development. But we're working with them on that. Now, just the bill, why is it here? I know everybody looks at it. The federal government deals with trade policies, but in fact, the states have broad authority over procurement policies. And a number of years ago, when the Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA, as it's known, was moving forward, and the trade office in Washington actually asked the current administration if they'd be committed to it. The governor did commit Minnesota's executive branch agencies to abide by the procurement rules. However, after it was passed in 2005, the governor, and I just have found this out recently, in fact, the governor did rescind the authority, our approval of CAFTA. So currently, we are one of eight states that where the governors have rescinded their support of the Central American Free Trade Agreement. The point I bring that out is that it took some great digging to actually find this out. And everybody I've asked, including Representative Rick Greener, the bill author, all of our folks, any legislator I've asked, and some folks within the departments actually didn't know this. And I guess the point is that somehow the legislature and the people should probably be involved and at least know what's going on these trade agreements. The types of procurement, and I think that's probably the reason it was rescinded, the types of things that preferences, actually some of the programs you heard about tonight, could actually be in violation of federal trade law if some other country wanted to come in and bid on put on a project here in Minnesota. Ideas like prevailing wage, cleaner alternative fuels, ethanol production, other environmental considerations, toxic chemicals, recycled content, things like that, that if our state laws or actually a county or ordinance and that sort of thing were in violation, they could come in. I don't think want to see that, and I'm not trying to say all this is going to happen, because no, it probably won't, but I think at least we should have an idea when agreements come forth what it could affect, because I don't think people really understand that. So that's the main reason for the bill, like I said, and we are willing to work and have talked with the Department of Administration, Department of Employment and Economic Development about modifying the bill and making it more pointed. So thank you for your time, and happy to answer any questions at all.
Thank you, Representative Gunter.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Stan, does this mean NAFTA, GATT, those types of things? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, Representative Gunter. It means any federal trade policies. It doesn't mean you don't have to follow them, but it means if you do, like if the governor stamps we support NAFTA, and then any entrepreneur or business violates that, then we could be in violation of the NAFTA agreement statewide.
Representative Gunter.
So this means like with the CAFTA, if we choose to buy Minnesota products, we can do that without having to take care of that trade agreement. Is that right?
Madam Chairman, Representative Gunter, I think that would be the case, yes.
Thank you.
And maybe, Madam Chair,
yes.
Maybe Representative Gunter can get to the bottom of why the governor rescinded his support of CAFTA, because I got to give him credit for that, but I didn't know he did it. And, that's probably one of the few things we might agree on this legislative session. So.
Well, I agree with him on many of them, but I will ask that question.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Then. And did you have any, did Mr. Rhodes want to come down and speak to this?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, just like old times here. Jim Rhodes, Department of Administration. We're just talking about the process of the bill, not the policy. And the issue in Sections 2, we're assuming that Section 3 will probably come out, but Section 2, we're good, but we're not that good. It's requiring us to do a sophisticated economic analysis that would require expertise that we just don't do in a normal way of doing it. So we'd have to hire consultants to provide the analysis, and it just is really not in our area. So I appreciate the fact, and Mr. Leto and I have talked about it, and I'm sure there'll be an amendment that the bill travels through to fix up, so Department of Administration can make this work.
All right. Thank you. Any questions?
Just like old times, except he's making a little more money than I.
Representative Stevenson.
And I'm putting in more hours.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess to the author, and I'm trying to get the full grasp of this bill. So this is changing the authority of making the policy for trade agreements from the governor to the legislature. Is that correct?
Well, I think it's actually not usurping his authority in that regard, but it requires the legislature to be a part of the agreement, to be informed and be a part of it in conjunction with the governor. And then there is a lot of other criteria and findings in here that, you know, are on top of that.
Representative Severson.
And forgive me, Madam Chair, and Representative Rokovina, you know, long days make for bad legislation is kind of my thoughts here, but I just wanted to kind of get the feel on this. So what happens when the legislature isn't in session and there's a requirement for an agreement on a trade deal? Do we come back in a special session or do we?
I wouldn't imagine that we'd have to come back in a special session, and I hope there are some safeguards in here that the legislative contacts that are in the bill would be able to work in conjunction, but maybe I'll have Mr. Leonard make sure.
Mr. Leonard.
Representative Severson, there is a provision that says that the agreement has to be submitted a day that the legislature is both in session, so it would be, I mean, if it had to be done, they don't always have to be done immediately, so it could be wait till the next session. If not, it would be up, the governor would have the, if he wanted to call a special session for one day, I would think everything would certainly be worked out in advance then, so that if it was going to happen, it would be a quick special session. But it doesn't require him to do that. I mean, he could wait until the next regular session, or the governor always has the ability to call a special session.
Representative Cedar.
Yeah, thanks. Just final question. So basically what this does is it links the governor and the legislature together, that the governor cannot make a unilateral decision. Is that correct?
Correct. I'm Madam Chair. I'm sorry.
That's the letter. Any other questions? Yes, Representative McFarland.
Madam Chair, just a matter of process. Is this going to any other committees, like the Commerce Committee?
Representative Rukavina?
No one has asked for it, Representative McFarland. So I would assume if we're going to do something, it would go in our omnibus bill, and I would hope that by that time we'd have some agreement reached with any concerns that admin and you or others might have on this.
Madam Chair, I was just wondering if this has anything to do with commerce, or is that not in there?
Representative Rukavina.
Well, no one has asked for it, so I'm not going to let it be asked for it. No one else is worried about it.
Okay.
Representative Atkins, I'm sure.
Yeah, I was going to say Representative Atkins. What do you think?
Representative Atkins would have asked for it, I'm sure, if he had wanted to see it, which he, on a number of other bills, could have had some type of authority this evening, but waived his.
I believe that perhaps Representative Atkins has been approached throughout this and does not want to see it. So.
Well, that's what I would think, too.
All right. Any other final comments? Otherwise, yes, Representative Clark.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank Representative Rukavina for bringing this bill and the others for putting it together. Minnesota is going to catch up with some other states that are trying to look at this issue, and it really is about the ability of our state to have control of our own state sovereignty. So I really appreciate you bringing it forward.
All right. Thank you, Representative Rukavina. Now we'll go back to Representative Clark, House File 1504. And Representative Clark recommends approval of 1504 in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. This should be a very short presentation. This bill actually is putting back language that passed both bodies last year and was in the conference committee and then somehow disappeared as things did in those final days. What it does is it adds a criteria to the Minnesota Investment Fund, which is an existing fund for promoting economic development in many ways. It's an existing statute. And it adds one more criteria to, I think there's there's six, it adds a seventh one, which says another priority to consider is
those businesses that would promote conversion to manufacturing environmentally safe production and products. So it's an additional little incentive, I guess you might say, for some of our businesses who want to convert their operation and their products to more environmentally friendly products. There's no opposition that I know of, and it's been around, like I say, for the second year.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes, Representative McFarland.
I'm Representative Park. This is an and, not an or. It just seems like we're maybe limiting some possibilities.
Representative Park.
So these are criteria. They don't have to reach every one of these goals. These are a number of criteria. That's my understanding. We're just adding to the kinds of things that we would like the investment fund to be able to fund. These have never been exclusive as far as I know. So, for example, you could get one that leverages private investment and, you know, promotes employment and maybe does this or not.
Any other discussion? It's like to throw it out. Anybody else have any comments? Okay, then House File 1504 is recommended to pass and put on the omnibus bill.
Try again.
Okay, we're just going to move along. House File 822, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair members. I would like to ask a couple people from the community to come down. This is a bill that extends the expiration date for the Neighborhood Revitalization Program.
Representative Clark, would you just...
And I'll move that House File 822 to be recommended. I believe it needs to go to local government.
Oh, okay.
Soviet Union.
So, members, some of you may be familiar with the Neighborhood Revitalization Program. It's a program that was passed years ago, and will be expiring coming up to its 20th year in 2009. And it's basically what I'd like to say is it's the way in our city in Minneapolis that neighborhoods have had some say about the economic development that's going on in the community. So much economic development, housing, jobs, businesses, and so on are driven by bigger forces. And this is the one way that we kind of bring home the decisions and the opportunities. And I have to say my neighborhood is probably what's kept us alive, and there's several people here from several neighborhoods who'd like to just say a little bit about it. This is a work in progress, I have to say. What we're trying to do here, there is a delete everything amendment, which
yes,
you have.
Yes.
If I could move that, Madam Chair Member.
Okay, and that's 822DE2?
Correct. And it basically, what it does, members, it says the existing Neighborhood Revitalization Policy Board, so I'm not creating any new structure here, would evaluate the need for the continued funding, which would be expiring, as I mentioned, in 2009, unless they did this evaluation, and allow them to present that to the legislature. And it talks about helping them keep the commitment that was made when this project was first started, that we have $20 million for 20 years dedicated to this particular process. That amounts to, that's where the $400 million comes from. These are city dollars, and we're just making sure that the process would, again, continue at a neighborhood community-based level. If I could, I'd like to ask a couple people to comment about the
sure, right before we do that, if we could just move the amendment here. So the delete all amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed say nay. That's been approved. You can go ahead and test like fires, please.
Yeah.
Go ahead and state your name.
Hi, my name is Carol Pass, and I'm from East Phillips in Minneapolis. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for letting me speak. I have handouts.
Okay, one of the pages. We'll be able to distribute those.
And the crucial handout is the first one, which shows, that one. And you just have to look at it and send it on. There's only four.
Okay.
My computer wouldn't do all that. What it shows is the situation in East Phillips when we first started with NRP. I've been doing a lot of research because I'm trying to write some grants for the neighborhood. And honestly, I've known how good NRP is, but but I was shocked when I looked at the city statistics and the graphs. And actually, the vacant and boarded housing is the graph for that. It's moving up at about a 45-degree angle in terms of vacant and boarded. And the picture, the green map that you see there, those, you can see the blue and red dots, and it's astounding. I mean, it's astounding how bad it was. I know that after NRP, the graph is going like this. I don't have a copy. I hope I get to do this again. I don't have a copy, but it goes like this, and then it just starts going like this. As NRP comes on board, you see a dramatic shift in the housing. You also see a dramatic shift in poverty. You see a dramatic shift in crime. And I know you may not know this, but NRP won a UN award for creative impact on a city in this process. We built about 26 homes in East Phillips, about maybe 40 over in Midtown Phillips, with NRP filling the gap. We have no staff. We don't spend any money on an office. It all goes into the neighborhood. We do some kids programs, but primarily we've restored housing. And you can see there's a before and after of that apartment building and a before and after of the townhomes. There are 28 of those townhomes. We put in $250,000 NRP dollars, and we managed to get grants and bring in homeowners. That's about a $9 million project. And we did that with volunteers and with NRP on the table first. We always have this experience where people don't want to come in unless there's public money. They want to be second on the list. You can't make them second unless you plop your money on the table. And then you have the power of the neighborhood, the will of the neighborhood, you have public money, and then you start in. We hired our own architects, and we went and sought our own developers. We did a competitive process. We all learned all kinds of stuff. But I have to say, I would have to say that we saved this part of town. We saved the near south side of Minneapolis. It was a disaster. I've lived there for 25 years, and I raised my kids there. I was a former college teacher, and then I got into doing this. But we had so many vacant lots. We had so much crime. Every vacant lot was a parking lot for pimps and prostitutes and drug dealers. And we simply, the whole place was just a ragtag, third world experience, out of control, filled with everything you can imagine. Even on Bloomington Avenue, I came down here last year and was requesting something, but when we did our statistics on Bloomington Avenue, we determined that 60% of our drug dealers that are buyers come from outside of the city, and they are statewide. So we were struggling with a statewide situation, and we resolved a lot of it with NRP. And I have to say, my theory is this. Cancer starts in a teeny spot. You have to look for a little tumor, and it's very little. But if you don't treat it, it eats the whole thing. Before NRP, I'd have to say Minneapolis was in that kind of state. There were multiple tiny tumors everywhere. You don't see them from City Hall, from a big city. You just don't see them. They get out of control. And the genius of NRP is that you allow the people, facilitate the people that are near those sites to attack them and give them the resources to deal with them before they're out of control. And I have to say, I don't know what we're going to do. We're struggling with a lot of immigrants. We're struggling with a downturn in the economics and et cetera, and a lot of foreclosures. And we're working with the foreclosures with our NRP. But for Minneapolis to have turned around, its population starts coming back, its housing is coming back, we need to continue this program. I would like to see it be permanent. I think that I'm getting calls from Kansas City to talk about what we did. And yet we're almost ready to start not doing it anymore. This doesn't make sense to me. So I hope that you can give this a lot of support. I think it's 21st or 22nd century.
Alright. Thank you.
I have one more witness, Madam Chair.
Go ahead and state your name, please, for the record.
Yes, good evening. My name is Greg Lecker, and I'm from the Bryn Mawr neighborhood in Minneapolis. And I thank you very much for your time listening to us. Over the years of Minneapolis and our peer, hundreds of our neighbors invested thousands of hours of sweat and time in revitalizing our neighborhood. NRP was responsible for this. It takes some money sometimes to get people's attention, and it gave us the opportunity to be able to survey folks at the beginning of NRP, to write a very comprehensive action plan, and to implement our Phase 1 over roughly 8 years. With this NRP Phase 1 funding, we leveraged over another 50% of money, some funding public, some others private, to revitalize housing, businesses, parks, schools, put in a bike trail, planted many, many trees, busted a lot of buckthorn, looked at some traffic and transportation issues that we have in the neighborhood as a result of a very large highway, 394, coming between two different parts of the neighborhood. We hope to be as successful in Phase 2, the majority of which will be implementing a housing program starting this summer, and much of that will be a needs test-based housing program just like it was in Phase 1. Continued funding of NRP will allow neighbors throughout the city to implement their vision for their parks, their schools, their businesses, their housing, traffic and safety concerns throughout the city. And it's very important that we do this. A copy of our progress report of Phase 1 is available on our website, www.bmna.org, and it details in excruciating detail, so I know I kind of put it together, the amount of money leveraged, a lot of pictures of completed projects, and we will be documenting Phase 2 just as detailed. So a report would be great for folks to have for the legislature to see the benefits of this program. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Rukavina.
Representative Clark, the change that you did here, you know, you were in your original bill, you were just going to extend the bond issuances, right? Mm-hmm. Or that could be issued.
Right. Well, we're just going to extend the existing program, right?
And now what we're doing, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, is asking the policy board to come back with recommendations about what really is the best way to continue the program with the existing tax increment financing, or if there are other ideas on how we should do that. So that's one of the reasons we will be going to local government to be getting some additional, have some additional discussion about that. But what is clear here, what is the same, is that we want to keep the commitment that was in the original bill, which was 20 years, $20 million from that funding. And so that language is still in here. It's preserved. It's just kind of how we're going to work it out. That
so, Madam Chair,
yes, Representative
Kahn, you are going to move this to local government, and I assume then go to taxes? Or what are you going
to
do?
I don't know that it'll need to go to taxes, but I guess... Actually, I had not talked with the tax chairman about that.
But the bill, I mean, your motion is to refer it to local government affairs.
Yeah.
And then from there, it's wherever.
Right.
It's the
it could be taxed, but I'm not sure it'll need to go there. But if it does, it'll go.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Then Representative Clark renews her motion that House File 822, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the local government committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
And I believe there's nothing else to come before us, so the meeting is adjourned.